They should not be selling non-essential items. If you go on the website, all the essential items are sold out. Until you restock and until you close this building, shut it down. Dildos are not essential items. Books for kids, yes, but dildos? No.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
So John Jones got into trouble again last week and got himself arrested for DWI. Not the first time, but lucky him, he reached a plea deal. And as part of his punishment, he has to complete a 90-day outpatient treatment program online because of the ongoing pandemic. And hold on to your horses here. You're not going to believe this. He has to complete 96 hours under what basically amounts to house arrest. Yes, house arrest during a pandemic. When everyone is basically under house arrest. The way this guy seems to slip out of trouble every time he fucks up, I'm going to have to start calling this guy Slenderman. It's unbelievable. This is episode 646 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 5th, 2020. I am the Solid Monster. Night one of WrestleMania is in the books. We had over 3,500 people watching live last night during my YouTube stream. Not quite the record. We came close. Not quite the record. The record was Hell in a Cell last October. We had over 4,000 people watching live. And boy, were those people angry about that main event with Seth Rollins and The Fiend. It's amazing how sometimes, you know, the way that anger stirs people to want to commiserate with others is quite the sight to behold. YouTube appears to be shadow banning people. I don't know what YouTube is doing. They're playing games. And a lot of you said that you never got a notification last night. If you are subbed to the channel, and I encourage everybody to please subscribe to the YouTube channel, you are supposed to get notifications when a new upload goes up or when I go live. And I heard from a whole bunch of people who said they never got a notification. It never hit their sub box about the stream going up. And they had to go to my Twitter to find out that, you know, I even posted anything. So I'm sure that wrecked my views a little bit. So thanks, YouTube. So just know that I am going live again tonight. So if you are subbed and do not get a notification, if you're wondering, hey, is Solid Monster going live? I am. I am going live again tonight when WrestleMania Night 2 goes off the air. As for this episode, I'm going to have some quick thoughts on Night 1 in a little bit. I've also pushed the audio for Night 1 out to the feed. So if you don't see it yet, you should be seeing that soon. But go to the YouTube channel, give that video a like, follow along with the comments. It's always fun, I think, to check out the live stream archive on YouTube. But I'll have some thoughts on that. Plus, my review of the new WWE Untold episode on Shawn Michaels versus Kurt Angle from WrestleMania 21. My Dark Side of the Ring review on the life and crimes of New Jack. What a mindfuck that episode was. RSPW Rewind is back, and IGN has a list of the top 10 wrestling games of all time, and I've got a little bone to pick with it. So the work never ends. This is podcast number 2 of 3 this weekend. Let's get to it. Jim Ross has a brand new book out, his second book, called Under the Black Hat. If you would like to download the book for free, you may do so using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. This is the book where he gets into his relationship with Vince McMahon, which is always very interesting, and all the times that Vince McMahon loved to bully good old JR and pick on good old JR. I'm sure he has a lot of interesting perspectives on that. And obviously they get into the death of his wife and a lot of that stuff from the latter part of his career. So it's called Under the Black Hat. Get it for free, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. The audiobook is narrated by JR himself, and that's one way to support the show. You can become a PayPal VIP, as many people did this week, for which I am very grateful. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. As I roll call all of our VIPs here, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Killshot Keith Hart, Jerome You're Going Down Eugenio, Downtown Kenny Brown, I did get your super chat, so thank you, brother. The Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes, who says it is WrestleMania weekend. Cannot believe this is actually happening. Well, Vince McMahon says, believe it, pal. WrestleMania is going on. Steven Handyman Halistick, thank you. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Max the Axe Velado, Recon Russell Bullware, Filthy Rich Richard Sanders, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Project Zero Mortals Wayne Ashanti, the Rabbit King Christian Dye, Nitrous Oxide Nathan Cania, the Sin City Superstar Peter Sanders, I don't believe any relation to the Richard Sanders who donated this week. If there is, perhaps we can have a fight to the death. We got to put some kind of PayPal King of the Ring type tournament here. Put something together. Josh the Shooter Stockton, D-Venom, Johnny Rue, Dream Killer, Stefan Ziegler, Dark Soul, Jeff Cole, Real Man, Renato Lucifora. Let's swap some recipes once we both figure out how to cook. Calamity, Kevin Clinton, and Alexander, happy birthday, my friend. Even with all that is going on in the world right now, you guys stepped up in a big way this week, as you can tell. I cannot tell you how much that means to me. And even on all the streams, we're going to do it all over again tonight. It's been a blast at a time when things aren't necessarily a blast. So it's been nice to hang out with everybody and hear from everybody. And one last quick shout out here for the Rhode Island Renegade, Blake Moran, who along with his two co-hosts, Colby and David, run a YouTube channel and they run a Twitch channel of the same name. It's called Keep Tappin' X. And on the YouTube side, they do video game Let's Plays. They have a series called Flashback, where they play an old Flash or Shockwave game and tell you if it's worth your time, plus other video game content and discussions. Later on today, before night two of WrestleMania, they're debuting their new Let's Play series on what he believes is one of the best wrestling games of all time, WWE Day of Reckoning. But more importantly, on the Twitch side, this Friday, April 10th, through Saturday, April 11, from noon to noon, from bell to bell, Eastern Time, they're going to be doing a 24-hour live stream playing the newly released Final Fantasy VII Remake, raising money for the American Cancer Society. They did this last year for the Kingdom Hearts 3 release and doubled their initial goal. Join in the fun! Go to twitch.tv/keeptappinx and on YouTube at youtube.com/keeptappinx. Also, I forgot to mention, you know, with the stream last night and also the WrestleMania predictions that I did the other day, I've been doing some video stuff. So if you're wondering, hey, when is Solomonster going to start pumping out more of the video content? He hasn't dropped a new inbox on YouTube in a while. Was on camera last night. I'll be back on cam tonight. And I do plan to push out another inbox very soon. Some WrestleMania Night 1 notes. The first ever empty arena WrestleMania. First, though, SoFi Stadium, the site of next year's WrestleMania, WrestleMania 37, and the future home of the Rams and the Chargers in the NFL, is still under construction, and it is expected to open in late July. That much we already knew. However, that could be in jeopardy after one worker tested positive for you-know-what. And at least one other worker is presumed to have tested positive as well. So a lot of the workers on site, and they have 3,000 people, construction workers, carpenters, all kinds of workers working on site, are now rightfully very worried about their health. And if construction ends up being halted on that new stadium, that could potentially impact next year's WrestleMania. So, you know, when I talk about everything that's going on, and, you know, I know everyone's trying to be optimistic and everything, but when I say that it could potentially bleed over into next year's WrestleMania, this is one of the reasons why. Not saying they're going to shut down construction, but it seems like, you know, the workers there are getting very uneasy about what's going on. So if anything impacts the you know, the finality, the completion of the construction of the actual stadium itself, then yes, that could have an impact on WrestleMania. So that's going to be a story to follow. Twitter poll results for night one so far. You can still vote at Solomonster on Twitter. We have over 5,000 votes in already. 72% thumbs up, 28% thumbs down for night one of WrestleMania. I'd call that an overwhelmingly positive response. You know, kind of in line with what my overall thoughts were last night, which was, I give the show a slight thumbs up. I can't give it an enthusiastic thumbs up. I give it an Orange Cassidy thumbs up. 6, maybe 6.5 out of 10. Because up until, you know, that, some like the last few matches on the show, it did not feel like a WrestleMania. And that hurts the show. And I understand that these were extenuating circumstances and their hands were tied if they were going to move ahead with the show. You can't have a crowd. You can't have pyro. You can't have a big stage and big stadium. But that's what WrestleMania is. And when you promote WrestleMania and you put all these matches out and there's no reaction, there's no fans to play off of, it doesn't have the pomp and the circumstance that you expect from WrestleMania, it's going to affect your opinion of the show. I saw CM Punk made a comment the other day. I don't remember who he was talking to. And they asked CM Punk, what do you think about WWE moving ahead with WrestleMania this year? And he said that it's completely unwatchable. To him, professional wrestling without an audience is, in his words, unwatchable. And I can't really disagree with him too much. I don't want to say unwatchable because, you know, last night there were certain things that I really liked that worked. And not just the main event. You know, the ladder match, the Kevin Owens Seth Rollins match with no crowd. They're able to trash talk more and you can hear them. And sometimes that works. Sometimes the absence of the live audience actually enhances certain aspects of the match. But on the whole, I don't really disagree with CM Punk. Wrestling without an audience is not natural. Wrestling without an audience is not, it's not very watchable. But I still think overall it was more thumbs up than thumbs down. But I can't go higher than that. I mean, I can't go higher than a 6 or so, between 6 and 6.5 out of 10, because it just didn't feel like a WrestleMania. It just didn't. You know, doing it spread out over two nights, I think, helps, because they had so many, I mean, 18 matches. We had 16. Apparently 16 tied the all-time record. Then they tacked on two kickoff matches, one for last night, one for tonight. That brings the total to 18 matches, which is an all-time record for WrestleMania. You had to split it up. Can't do that all in one night, not in an empty building. So for this year, it worked. I do appreciate the fact that the show ended at 10 p.m. I never thought we would see another WrestleMania that ended at 10 p.m. That I liked. That actually kind of gives me a little bit of hope that maybe this double night concept could work if they were to implement it in the future. But the main event I see has a lot of varied opinions. I see more positive than negative, but there were a lot of people who hated that main event last night. AJ Styles technically headlines. He technically main events his very first WrestleMania. For people who have asked me, does it count? Does this count as a WrestleMania main event for AJ Styles? The answer is yes. You know, the show was divided into two nights. When the show went off the air, that was AJ's match. Technically, he is a WrestleMania main eventer. Undertaker already was a WrestleMania main eventer. I loved the Boneyard match. I thought it was fantastic. Some people said it wasn't a match, it was a skit. Call it whatever you want, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's all semantics here, really. I have no problem calling it a match, but if you want to call it a skit, you want to call it, come up with whatever terminology you want to use. I enjoyed it. I was entertained by it. I thought it was the absolute best possible thing they could have done at this stage of his career with The Undertaker. You know, and look, he can't do a lot of the things he used to do. He is older. His body is broken down. They're admitting it on television. Love all the people who say to me, you know, and there's big Undertaker fans who get very offended when I speak truth to power about The Undertaker. They feel I'm disrespecting The Undertaker. No, I'm telling the truth. And the truth hurts. Father Time is a bitch. Undertaker is older. He's put his body through hell. I have nothing but respect for what the man has done, but it is painful to watch him in the ring when he wrestles a match these days. So they took him out of his element. They basically put together like a mini movie, a mini Hollywood presentation in a graveyard somewhere with spooky music. I love the decision to lay the spooky music down and cut out the commentary. I think the commentary would have killed it. Imagine fucking Byron Saxton or JBL talking over the action last night. That would have sucked. So that was a smart call, whoever made that decision. It set the mood, it set the tone for the match. I thought AJ was very entertaining. Just a total prick. Undertaker rides in on the Harley or whatever motorcycle it was to Metallica, not Kid Rock. But he rides into Metallica. Either way, it's music they're going to have to dub over in the future. So in the end, who cares? It's going to end up being some generic theme anyway. But he rides in on that motorcycle. He's got the bandana on. He's got the jeans. He's got the leather vest. He's talking shit. This was the American Badass. This was the Big Evil version of The Undertaker. For everybody who's been clamoring to see that one more time, you got it. You got it last night. When it was over, he got back on his bike and he rode off. Undertaker, as I predicted, as I knew would happen, literally buried AJ Styles in their match last night. And it doesn't bother me that much because, again, I was entertained by it. To me, there was no other outcome here that I expected. But I will say that AJ Styles did get done dirty in this way. Not just because he literally had dirt thrown on him. Think about the trajectory of this feud from the very beginning, right? It all kicked off with a comment that AJ made back in February where he was running down the list of all the legends. He didn't have a match for WrestleMania. He talked about The Undertaker, talked about Shawn Michaels. I'm going to be the new Mr. WrestleMania. That's really how this whole thing kicked off. And then we go to Saudi Arabia and there's the trophy gauntlet and The Undertaker shows up, never takes his hat off. Chokeslams AJ, pins him, wins the trophy, and leaves. So that was the first time Undertaker got one over on AJ Styles. And we go to Elimination Chamber, right? AJ had that match, I believe, with Aleister Black. Undertaker made his presence felt, cost AJ the match. That's two matches that The Undertaker cost AJ Styles. Explain to me, or remind me, when AJ got one over on The Undertaker on television. I know he was, you know, cutting promos on Michelle McCool and all that. Undertaker and OC. Not once did they get one over on The Undertaker. Not once did they lay out The Undertaker. Did they do some big angle where, you know, he gave him the Styles Clash or he tried to murder The Undertaker. It was all Undertaker all the way through. All AJ did was cut a few promos. So after losing in Saudi Arabia, after losing at Elimination Chamber, he goes to WrestleMania and he loses. So I was looking at that and I was going, you know, I love the match. And I think AJ will be fine because AJ is kind of Teflon. He's a made guy. But boy, they didn't give this guy shit. He was cutting some of the best promos of his career, but they really didn't give him anything in this feud. It was really like Undertaker just would go out there and bury him every single week. And Anderson and Gallows, I mean, they're treated like a couple of goobers anyway. So I don't think this did the OC any favors. But I think this was the best presentation of The Undertaker that we could have expected. I wouldn't mind seeing them try more of these types of matches. I'm on the opposite end from the people who it's a skit and they didn't like it. They thought it was terrible. I thought it was great. I thought this was one of the more memorable matches in WrestleMania history that will go down, I think, in a very favorable light. I think this will be one of the more well-liked, well-remembered Undertaker matches at WrestleMania. So I give them a lot of credit. They had to think outside the box. They did. They could have done more. You know, with the whole unholy trinity thing, nobody made an appearance. There was no Kane. There was nobody. Different incarnations of The Undertaker. They didn't do that. I wanted it to go longer. I wanted them to brawl into a different part of the boneyard somewhere. Make more use of their surroundings. If I had one criticism, I was all in on this. But if you missed it, if you didn't see it, I would say go back. It's worth a watch because it's unlike anything they've ever done before. Matt Hardy should be very proud. His influence, the influence of Final Deletion in the Broken Universe, was all over this match. All over this match. And I suspect it'll be very similar tonight with the Firefly Funhouse match, which I am also looking forward to. We learned a few weeks ago that it was taped in a warehouse, and they gave it the full movie treatment. So if last night felt like some kind of scene from a horror movie, what do you think the Firefly Funhouse match is going to look like tonight? I am looking forward more to that match than any other match tonight on the card. I want to see what they do. I want to see how they film this. That and Edge and Randy Orton. Those are the two matches I'm really looking forward to tonight. We had Braun Strowman winning the Universal Championship. Not a move that I would have made. I've made that very clear. I would have just kept the championship on Goldberg. You went through all the trouble to bring him back and beat The Fiend. To put the championship on Goldberg. And clearly they had an agenda as far as who they wanted to get that championship onto. It is inevitable. It's going to happen. Just a matter of when and not if. And they start building this big match. The Battle of the Spears. Goldberg and Roman Reigns. And look, it's not as though I had sky-high expectations for what that match was going to look like. But if that was your idea, then stick with the plan. You know, Goldberg, there's going to be a lot of people just sitting around, I think, for the next few months if they have to shut things down. And it's increasingly looking like that may be what ends up having to happen, unless they just tape a whole bunch of TV this week. You know, I don't know. I don't know if they'll be able to. They are taped through NXT this Wednesday. As of SmackDown this Friday, I have no idea what their plans are. But I would have kept the championship on Goldberg, waited to get that title on somebody who they actually care about, who they actually are going to push and going to promote. Braun Strowman getting the championship almost as a consolation. All right, you know, whatever, good for him. I don't like the way they did this. You know, Goldberg went in there, he hit three spears, tried to pin him, didn't work. Hit another spear, went for the jackhammer. Strowman came back, hit a bunch of power slams, and won. It went about as long as it should have. That's the best thing I could say about the match. They didn't overstay their welcome. It went about 2 minutes and 10 seconds. That's about in line with what I think they should have done. But the way they handled this whole situation, I understand they were put in a difficult spot. They got late notice from Roman Reigns. Roman was all over that pirate-themed intro to WrestleMania last night. They got late notice from Roman that he was pulling out days before. But the way they handled the announcement of the change, the match change, was deplorable. Especially after hearing Triple H talk about, well, I'm not going to reveal what we're doing here. It's going to be very unique. Oh, it's going to be a very unique way of announcing the change. You know, I don't want to give away the movie ending, he said, before the movie airs, before the movie takes place. Well, guess what? That movie sucked. And so did WWE's handling of that entire situation. Now, if you want my full recap of the show, because I had a lot more to say about the show, including that ladder match, the Becky Lynch match, she is still the Raw Women's Champion, Kevin Owens and Seth Rollins. I, again, have just pushed the audio out to the feed, or you can go to YouTube right now and check out the full WrestleMania Night 1 review. Tonight is night two. Here are the matches for tonight. Brock Lesnar defends the WWE title against Drew McIntyre. We have the Firefly Funhouse match, John Cena and The Fiend. If you missed my predictions the other day, I do think they're going to change the title to Drew. I believe Bray is going to get his win back over John Cena. I even floated the idea last night. I said, you know, not only is he going to beat Cena, but it would be kind of interesting if at the end of the match, since it's going to just be, I'm sure, batshit crazy, over the top, puppets and all that kind of stuff. What if he turned John Cena into a puppet in the Firefly Funhouse? Because John Cena is going to go away. John Cena is going to go back to making movies. And so going forward, in all of the Firefly Funhouse segments, we have a new Cena puppet. Cena has technically now, he has been trapped with this loss inside of the Firefly Funhouse. Now, at some point, you'll have to explain, you know, when he does come back. But I actually think that would be kind of clever. I floated that idea months ago when the Fiend stuff first started. At the very beginning, I had the suggestion. I said, you know, it would be kind of fun if each person he beats, Finn Balor, Daniel Bryan, The Miz, all these people, he beats them and they get their own place in the funhouse. They get their own puppet. He can just, everybody he beats, everybody he destroys, they're added to the funhouse. It's as if their soul is trapped. Now, they'd still be on TV, There's no way around that, right? I mean, you can't just take everybody he beats off of television. But that whole concept of them turning into a puppet, we'll see. We'll see if they do that with Cena tonight. There's any number of directions they can go in, but the only thing that matters here is that The Fiend beats John Cena. Gets his redemption from WrestleMania 30, and then moves on to his next challenger. We have a fatal five-way for the SmackDown Women's Championship. Bayley defending against Sasha Banks, Lacey Evans, Naomi, and Tamina. Sasha Banks, I believe, was my pick to win. Because I was going back and forth. Does Bayley keep it? Do you draw it out a little bit? I think Sasha probably gets the championship here. Edge and Randy Orton, last man standing. Has to be a win for Edge. This is the best promoted match that they've put together for WrestleMania. I think the promo work between these two has been outstanding. The best work Randy Orton's done in years. The best work Edge has done in 9 years. Hardy har har. Charlotte Flair challenges Rhea Ripley for the NXT Women's Championship. I think Rhea goes over. I think there's going to be a big win for Rhea Ripley. No need to send Charlotte to NXT. She's already been the NXT Women's Champion. I don't see what the big deal is if she wins the belt back. It's not like it's her first time. I'm going with Rhea Ripley. We have the Raw Tag Team titles. Street Profits defending against Angel Garza and Austin Theory. See no reason to take the belts off of Montez and Angelo. Otis seeks revenge on Dolph Ziggler, who we now know was put up to going and meeting up with Mandy Rose on Valentine's Day in the restaurant. She was put up to it, or he was put up to it, by Sonya Deville. Got the big storyline twist on SmackDown Friday night, which I'm going to talk more about in a second. Anyway, Otis and Ziggler, got to give the win to the big guy. Got to go with Otis on this one. And then hopefully he'll get to kiss the girl when it's all said and done. If I'm Mandy, I'm going to kiss Otis just to make Sonya jealous. Still think it's possible they end up doing something with Mandy and Sonya. Sure, a lot of people are excited about that. She wants to make Mandy jealous. Can plant a nice big wet one on Otis. That's what Sonya did not want. It's a spite kiss. Remember Larry David? He opened a spite store. Latte Larry's on Curb Your Enthusiasm. This will be a spite kiss from Mandy Rose. If Aleister Black taking on Bobby Lashley, it should be a win for Aleister. And Liv Morgan takes on Natalya in the kickoff match. If you're wondering why, I don't fucking know. Because even though there's no people in the building, we gotta get everybody on the WrestleMania card. Even though there's nobody there, gotta get everybody on the WrestleMania card. I go with Liv Morgan. You know, I mean, Natalya, she wins. If she loses, who cares? You know, Liv Morgan at least is somewhat new and just had a reboot of her character. I don't know why she would just go in here and lose, so I'll pick Liv Morgan. And so that's the WrestleMania Night 2 card for tonight. Now, on SmackDown Friday, I mentioned we had advancement, storyline advancement with Otis and Mandy and Dolph. There's a match between Tucker and Dolph Ziggler. And Ziggler was threatening to injure Tucker. Out comes Mandy asking Dolph to please stop. What are you doing? And Otis comes out. Anyway, up on the screen, we've been seeing these weird glitches on television now for a number of weeks. And we see them again. And then we see a shadowy, hooded, masked figure sitting at this control center. And the message on the screen is, the truth will be heard. This person turns around. We can't see his face or her face. Who knows who it is? They turn back around. They push a button on the control panel. And all of a sudden, it's like GTV is back. This would be quite the return to finish an unfinished storyline if we finally get a resolution to who and what GTV was. I know, you know, it was supposed to be for Dustin Rhodes. I know they had plans for it, but then they abandoned it. But in storyline, we never did find out exactly who was behind GTV. And that was what, 98? 99? Probably 98, right? Is when that angle started. Imagine if over 20 years later they said, hey, why don't we finish this whole GTV thing? this guy is, he's back, and now we're going to have the big reveal. They played the long game. This is long-term storytelling, long-term booking that you don't see in WWE. This was very much like a modern-day incarnation of GTV. Shows us secret surveillance footage from Valentine's Day when all that stuff went down. Sonya Deville basically conspired to convince Otis that Mandy was running late, even though she really wasn't. Mandy was appalled when she saw Sonya telling Dolph Ziggler, hey, go to the restaurant. It was all just one giant ruse by Sonya Deville. She was very upset. She was begging for an apology. Or she was, I should say, begging for forgiveness. She was apologizing to Mandy. Mandy didn't want to hear it. So the two of them right now are on not speaking terms. They're on bad terms now as this storyline plays itself out. The big question is, who is this masked shadowy figure? And I'm going to assume this is probably Mustafa Ali with some kind of new gimmick. That seems to be the prevailing thought. All right, the symbols, the circles on the screen seem to match the ones from his light-up glove. We talked about this many weeks ago. We haven't seen him on TV. You may as well put the fucking guy's face on the side of a milk carton. Do they do that these days? I've never in my life bought a milk carton with a picture of a child on the side of it saying, have you seen this child? Maybe I'm just buying the wrong milk. I buy that Silk soy milk. Maybe it's not on the soy milk containers. Maybe it's on a different kind of milk. I've never seen that in my life, but apparently that's been a thing for years and years and years. People go missing, you put their face on the side of a milk carton. This is America. Don't they realize that you should be putting people's faces on like a package of bacon? A bag of chips? Wouldn't that make more sense in this country since we eat such fucking garbage? Should put people's faces on a package of potato chips? Anyway, I'm going to say it's Mustafa Ali because I don't know what else, what are their plans for this guy? Where is he? Who else could it be? Apparently he's this new crusader now. He's this crusader of justice. He wants to speak truth to power. People lie and he's here to keep them honest. You know, maybe that's his new gimmick. Hey, he used to be a police officer. In real life, you know, in his background, he used to be a police officer. He's all about truth and justice. In a way, it kind of makes sense. Trying to keep him honest. On Friday, we also very quietly and very casually out of nowhere got what I believe to be the very first singles match in WWE between Daniel Bryan and Shinsuke Nakamura. And it really is amazing to me how Nakamura's stock has fallen so much since being, you know, absorbed into the WWE main roster. I'm not even putting all the blame on WWE. Nakamura seems content to just go out there and just have the same basic match every week. You know, we know what the guy is capable of. We've seen his work in years past, and, you know, he's older now, and it's the WWE style. He doesn't have to go as hard as he would in Japan. Good for the guy. You know, apparently he enjoys surfing. He likes, you know, living here in the States. He goes surfing in his time off. He gets to go out there every week and just have the same basic match. But all that fanfare that he had coming into the company has just completely evaporated, you know, at this point. It's just gone. And back then, Daniel Bryan made it very clear his favorite wrestler in the world at that time, before Nakamura even came in, was Shinsuke Nakamura, and he would love to work a match against him. And I think they used to be roommates many years ago. They, you know, they were friends. So here we go. After all these years, we get a singles match in an empty building, unannounced, the night before WrestleMania. It's not even the WrestleMania match. Think about that. Years ago, you would think, man, I can't wait to see Daniel Bryan against Shinsuke Nakamura in a WrestleMania match. This was unannounced in an empty building. I guess everything's empty building now, but I never imagined that we would be getting it in an empty building the night before WrestleMania as the setup to another match. But here we are. And for the time they were given, I thought it was very good, the match they had. They decided to replay the Shawn Michaels-Ric Flair match, the Ric Flair retirement match at WrestleMania 24, which was, you know, fun to go back and watch, and I'm all for them picking more classic matches that aren't from the last 5 years, or even the last 10 years, to go back and replay. I just thought the placement was very odd because it's the final SmackDown before WrestleMania, the night before. They've been replaying matches every week that somehow tie into promoting certain stars who are on the WrestleMania card, so Charlotte and Asuka, right? They showed that to kind of build up Charlotte for her match with Rhea. They showed us the WrestleMania main event from last year with Becky and Charlotte and Ronda. We've seen some Brock Lesnar matches, you know, Brock winning at the Royal Rumble against Rollins and Cena. And then all of a sudden we get a Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair match. Two guys who have been retired for years and years and years. I just thought that was very strange. Of all weeks, why would they choose that match? And then the John Cena promo to end the show. Basically, he is not afraid of the Fiend. He is going to finish what he started 6 years ago. We got a taste of what's to come, I think, tonight in that Firefly Funhouse match with some creepy music. The puppets are popping up everywhere in the empty crowd. There's Ramblin' Rabbit. There's Mercy the Buzzard. And there's Abigail the Witch. Right? We got to see all that. And the pig, Huskus. Lights go out, lights come back on. There's the Fiend up on the perch in the PC, having a stare down with Cena from afar. And then all of a sudden, Bray Wyatt, Mr. Rogers Wyatt, shows up behind Cena and spooks him. Says, "Let me in." All of a sudden, Cena looks very rattled. For a guy who said, "I'm not afraid of you," he looked pretty unnerved when they went off the air on Friday night. I love that finish. I love that final segment. Basically, the things that I love the most about WWE television this week were all of the goofy, kind of movie-esque type campy bullshit. There's a description for you. There's a description for you. That's the stuff I enjoyed the most. That is the stuff that I enjoyed the most. And I would say that if they do continue on, and they are going to pump out more original content over these next few months, and they're not going to basically just shut down for a while, I would be totally okay if this was kind of the new form or the new look of WWE programming going forward until they're able to get back in front of live audiences again. Stuff that they film almost like a movie. I would be okay with that, temporarily. I think I would be all right with that. But how much of that can you really film? You know, how much of that can you really pump out before it doesn't feel special anymore? I wouldn't do it every week, but this could be the way things, this could be the way things adapt in the future going forward. You know, if they get enough positive feedback about this stuff, it could open Vince McMahon's eyes. Apparently he never understood the Matt Hardy broken universe stuff. He just didn't get it. He didn't understand it. He didn't understand what was so appealing about it. Hopefully after that Boneyard match last night, you know, he can see the reaction, the largely positive reaction, and start to embrace the idea of at least, you know, thinking outside the box and trying to do some more stuff like this. You know, you don't have to do it all the time. But there is an audience for it. And it can work if we're a company that loves to talk about how we tell stories and we make movies. You know, that was a hell of a little mini movie they put together last night. So I'd like to see them do more of it. Now, due to the pandemic, New Japan has delayed the ticket on sale for their Wrestle Dynasty show this August in Madison Square Garden. The pre-sale was going to begin at 10 a.m. Eastern this Wednesday. It will now begin at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, May 13th. And tickets would then go on sale to the general public at 10 a.m. on Friday, May 15th. Wrestle Dynasty is scheduled for August 22nd. Saturday, August 22nd, the same night as NXT TakeOver in Boston. There is no way that this show is happening. I'll just put that out there right now. You want my opinion? There's no way this show is happening. Even if somehow it does, things begin to reopen, it's, you know, business as usual starts to kind of creep back, they're going to do the show, they're going to move ahead with it, MSG reopens because they're not doing any events right now. Even if that were to somehow happen, any chance that New Japan had of packing in the place is gone. It is out the window. And if you're a New Japan fan and you want them to have a good showing and, you know, be able to come back to MSG in the future, you want them to do well. You want them to sell out, or if they don't sell out, come close to selling out. Even just to get 10,000 people in that building, I think, for them, a foreign promotion, would be a huge accomplishment. No Ring of Honor, just a New Japan show. Not the joint show they did last year. You want them to go in there and pack the place in. And I guarantee you that if they start running shows again sometime in the summer and things begin to open up and they move ahead with Wrestle Dynasty, it will not do nearly as well as it would have done before. I don't even know why at this point they would want to run the Garden after all this. You're going to run a mostly empty Madison Square Garden? So I hope they're able to reschedule for next year, because they'll have a better chance of packing that place in. But to do it this summer sounds very optimistic to me. Some other WWE notes for those of you audiophiles who may not be aware because they don't bother to promote it. WWE released its Uncaged album, number 12, on Apple Music and Spotify this week. These are the old unreleased Jim Johnston tracks. This latest one is not as good as some of the other releases, but it's got tracks, for example, for Duke the Dumpster Drozzy, Saba Simba, Simon Dean, Right to Censor. But it also has the Steiner Brothers theme song. It's got Mick Foley's Commissioner theme, which is kind of like just a remixed version of his regular theme song. Whatever it's called. They have the Corporate Ministry theme. And they have Hollywood Rocks theme, specifically from the No Way Out pay-per-view in 2003, when he came out for his match against Hulk Hogan. It's got the sound effects in there from when he made his entrance that night. That is the best track on this entire album. Everything about Hollywood Rock was awesome. His music was no exception. So if you are interested in listening to that, that is up right now on Apple and on Spotify. Speaking of The Rock, Hulk Hogan and The Rock, bored and under quarantine like the rest of us, decided to sit down on their Instagrams or their YouTube channels, whichever it was. I think Rock has been doing Q&As on his Instagram, and somebody asked him to talk about his WrestleMania 18 match with Hulk Hogan. And Hogan then decided to sit down and record his own take, this 18-minute video of him sitting on his back porch, just talking openly about what went into him coming back to WWE in 2002 and the resistance to it, how the match with Rock got set up, what the match was like, the build to the match. One of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. You know, there really is not much else to say about it. Other than, according to Rock, Vince McMahon came to him about 6 months before they brought back Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash to ask him if he would be okay with them bringing back those three guys. Because those guys had a reputation, not a very good one, from their days in WCW. Very controversial, very political, and Vince, you know, he didn't want to rock the boat. So he wanted to go to his top guys like Rock and say, hey, are you okay with this? Are you comfortable with our doing so? Other members of the locker room had told Vince McMahon they had reservations about bringing those guys in. And so he wanted to know what The Rock thought. And The Rock said that, I'd love it. And he said, selfishly, he wanted to work with Hulk Hogan, so of course he wanted him back. And that's when Vince McMahon said to him, well, that's good, because I want to do you and Hogan at WrestleMania. Now, that would mean that Austin versus Hogan was never even under consideration. Unless Vince McMahon went to Austin first, and Austin was maybe one of those names who was against the idea of them coming in the first place. That I don't know. That's a better question to ask Steve Austin. But I was of the impression that Austin, the idea was broached. I don't know, maybe it never reached the serious stages, but the idea was pitched or it was broached to Austin and he didn't want the match, or he was offered the match and he turned it down. That was, that's always been my understanding. And Rock was sort of the backup plan, which is a hell of a backup plan to have, by the way. Your main plan falls through. All right, well, let's just do Rock and Hogan instead. Boy, that's a better backup plan than Braun Strowman against Goldberg, isn't it? Yeah, that's a hell of a backup plan. Let's go to Rock. Rock will be the backup. But it sounds like maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe Rock and Hogan, it was going to be that from the jump. The biggest, though, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, you don't even have to like the guy, Hogan, but the biggest missed opportunity for a true wrestling dream match was not doing Hulk Hogan against Stone Cold Steve Austin when they had the chance to do so. More than Undertaker against Sting, Rock against Shawn Michaels, which both I think would have been in their prime, in their heyday, tremendous matches. Or any other dream match that you could come up with. And I've rattled off some myself. Bret Hart against Kurt Angle. There's any number of dream matches that I wish we could have been able to see. But the biggest one of all, Hogan versus Austin. Hogan versus Austin was the biggest match to never happen that could have happened. WWE Network also released a new episode of WWE Untold. They did one last year on the Shawn Michaels Undertaker Hell in a Cell match at Bad Blood, the night that Kane made his debut. And they interviewed, you know, Glenn Jacobs for it. It was very well done. Very well done. This latest one, though, covering the Shawn Michaels-Kurt Angle match from WrestleMania 21, is their best one yet. And the match is one of the top 10 greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. Maybe even top 5. If I sat down and really thought about it and put a list together, it's possible it could crack the top 5. But if not, top 10 for sure. It's a match that when it was over, Bobby Heenan called it the greatest match that he had ever seen. Bobby Heenan has seen a lot of matches in his day. And he was gushing over it, apparently, and said that it was the best match he had ever seen. Kurt Angle himself, in this special, called it the greatest match of his career. Now, it has to be this, I would think, or the Benoit match from Royal Rumble in 2003, but, I mean, he's sitting down to be interviewed by WWE. So, he probably realizes, even if he felt that it was the Benoit match, he probably realizes, I really can't say that on a WWE show. So, we'll go with this one. Either way. It is a fantastic match, and this was a nice look back at what went into it, how we got there, the match itself. The talking heads in here were Shawn. They sat down with Shawn Michaels. They sat down with Kurt Angle, Michael Cole, and Johnny Gargano. Those were the four talking heads. I guess with Gargano, they wanted to get the perspective of a current star who was a fan back then watching the match, and Gargano is probably the biggest HBK mark that they have in that entire company. So, of course, he would want to be part of something like this. There were parts of this where Gargano came across like the biggest wrestling geek that you have ever seen. But in a way, it's kind of endearing, right? Because you can see how much of a fan he really is. Gargano says that this generation of stars was influenced by Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle, and you can tell if you watch any NXT TakeOver show. You see their influence written all over it. Although I don't remember Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle doing Destroyers in every single match, but apparently their influence is all over the current generation of talent. Michaels talked about injuring his back in 98, having to leave and go away for 4 years, and when he came back, he had to adapt, he had to adjust his style. He said that in his day, it was about making it look real, but not really hurting the other guy. And then he came back and he realized, well, that went out the window, and guys were just going in there and beating the piss out of each other. I love that analogy, and the reason I love it is because I first heard Bret Hart use that analogy many years ago. Bret Hart once said, and I think it's a great analogy, and I can understand it, and I can agree with it, that the real art of pro wrestling is giving the illusion of hurting your opponent when in reality you're not harming a hair on their head. You're not hurting them at all. You know, guys are going to get black and blues, they're going to get a busted lip, you know, a chipped tooth. Stuff like that, it's unavoidable. But the art of professional wrestling is making people believe that you are really hurting the person across from you in the ring. And in reality, when you go to the back, you shake hands, you hug, everybody's healthy, and nobody is hurt. And that's the real art of it. I mean, it's easy to smack somebody in the face. It's easy to smack somebody upside the head or in their eardrum, for real. But to make it look like you hurt the guy when you really didn't, I would imagine that that's a lot harder to do. You know, there are guys who come in who used to box or they used to play in the NFL. And I would imagine for those guys, it's an adjustment to have to pull their punches and to have to just pull back. You know, they're so intense. It's got to be difficult, I think, for them to adjust and say, listen, you know, your job is to not go in there. Or if you're an MMA fighter, there's a lot of MMA fighters who have transitioned over to pro wrestling. They're used to going in the octagon and trying to kill their opponent. The goal is to beat them into submission or knock them out. I would imagine there's a learning curve involved where when you go over to pro wrestling, it's all showmanship. You know, it's like you got to pull those punches, you got to pull those kicks, you got to pull those knees. It's got to be a hard thing to do. But I always thought that was a great way when I would hear Bret say that. It's a great way of describing the art of what these men and women do every time they set foot into the ring. Gargano talked about the Royal Rumble match in 2005, hearing about reports, rumors online, but you know, you can't believe everything you read. that they were preparing for a Sean Kurt match at WrestleMania, but it wasn't until he saw the two of them interact in the Royal Rumble match that he got really pumped. You know, Michaels dumped Kurt, Kurt came back in, dumped Michaels, and then he knew. He knew that they were off to the races for WrestleMania. And I have to say, that 2005 Royal Rumble match, low-key, is one of my favorite Rumble matches. I say low-key, and I'm not talking about Caval. I say low-key because I don't talk about it as much as I do say, oh, I don't know, the 1992 Royal Rumble. I think I've mentioned that maybe a couple of times over the years. But I don't mention this one as much. It's not as good as that one. But I thought it was a very enjoyable Rumble that year. Sean talked about the build to the match. They were on different shows. They had to find a way for it to work. And they did, you know, a whole bunch of angles. Kurt Angle would do, you know, I think he, on SmackDown, he issued some kind of open challenge for local talents to come wrestle him. And, you know, Sean was dressed up as a cameraman and did the big reveal and attacked Kurt. So all this, you know, back and forth type stuff. Gargano's favorite part of the entire build, his favorite part of the entire angle, is my favorite as well. One of the all-time great segments in SmackDown history. When Kurt Angle danced out to Sexy Boy, and he called out Sensational Sherry. Couldn't even tell you the last time Sensational Sherry was on WWE television, aside from her Hall of Fame induction. And it's a shame what happened to her. It's a shame, you know, the back problems and the pain pills and everything else, and you know, had she been able to get her back fixed, you know, maybe she'd still be here with us. It's really just bullshit what happened to her. But Sherry was great. Sherry was fantastic. You know, I couldn't help when I was watching the Dark Side of the Ring on Benoit, and they were talking about Nancy, you know, woman, and her role as a wrestling valet and how she doesn't really get the attention that she deserves. And she played her part to the hilt. And it made me think of Sherry. Sherry's the other one I would think of. Now, Sherry, unlike woman, Sherry wrestled. Sherry was a wrestler, but she was also a valet and a manager and a damn good one, and she could take bumps and do a lot of things that a lot of the women back then weren't doing. And she gets her just due, but also maybe not enough, maybe not as much as she should. So when she came out here, of course, she used to manage Shawn Michaels, and Kurt had already beaten Marty Jannetty on TV, Shawn's old partner. Now we got Shawn's old manager to come out. He was digging back in Shawn Michaels' history. And then they get in the ring, and Kurt says, well, Shawn Michaels thinks he's so great because he sang his own song. Well, anything you can do, we can do better. And the woman's voice that you hear at the beginning of Shawn Michaels' theme song, every time he comes prancing out, is Sherry. So he puts the mic in Sherry's face, Sherry does the screams, and then we get the rendition of Sexy Kurt. He's just a sexy Kurt. He'll make your ankle hurt. It's Kurt was awesome. I mean, what can I say? Kurt could do it all. Kurt could be intense. He could look like he's going to rip your head off 1 second. And then the next minute we get Goofy Kurt, who's doing stuff like this. Who's singing Sexy Kurt. Truly one of the greatest segments in SmackDown history. And then, of course, at the end, he threw Sherry down and put her in the ankle lock, and Kurt laughed and said, you'd never be able to see that today. Amen to that. People would have a conniption fit if they did that on WWE television. So then we get to the match itself, WrestleMania 21, and Shawn says that Pat Patterson was the one to suggest, you know, you do a slap. Do a hard slap at the beginning of the match. And so he used that slap here, and it worked. You know, before they even locked up, Kurt had a big smirk on his face, and Shawn smacked him right across the face. And Kurt told the story about a week or so before the match. I guess they were getting together to talk about it. And they really didn't know each other. They really weren't friends. They didn't really know each other very well. And as they're talking and they're you know, preparing for this match, he says that Michaels turns to him and goes, I just want you to know, I'm not afraid of you. And Kurt said he had no idea where that came from, because he thought, I'm a pretty easy guy to work with in the ring. You know, I don't know where that came from. But he figured that Shawn was just standing up for himself. He probably knew Kurt's reputation. He knew Kurt was a shooter. Great amateur wrestler, Olympian, Olympic gold medalist, all this stuff. And he just wanted to kind of give him a fair warning. So that when we get in the ring, if you try to take advantage of me, we're going to have a problem. I will say that if Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels ended up having a problem with each other, I would pick Kurt Angle 10 times out of 10. Kurt Angle would turn Shawn Michaels into a fucking Bachmann pretzel. So Gargano's talking about the match and all the mat work they did early on and trying to feel each other out. This is the first time the two of them ever worked together. This is their very first match. They went in there and had one of the greatest matches of all time. That tells you the chemistry, the instant chemistry that these two had when they stepped into the ring together. And Shawn said, one of the only submissions I even know is a short arm scissor, and so I put the short arm scissor on Kurt. This was like match anatomy here. That's what this was. And it was fascinating to listen to the two of them just talk about all the different spots and the German suplex attempt off the apron, which looked like Kurt was in a very compromising sexual position with Shawn. But he was trying to German suplex him off the apron, couldn't do it. And when Shawn gave him a low blow and avoided catastrophe with that move, the crowd booed. And Kurt laughed and said, I think the reason they booed is because they really wanted to see me hit the move. He goes, the problem is if I would have hit the move, Shawn Michaels wouldn't exist anymore if I had given him a German suplex off the apron. Angle said the biggest move of the match was Michaels doing a springboard dive out onto Angle on the announce desk. Table did not break. And Michael Cole is interviewed. He's laughing. He says, surprise, surprise, the tables are always supposed to break. And this one did not. And Michael said when that happened, the audience usually goes, oh, it didn't break. It's a botch and all that stuff. But then they realize that it hurts even more. When the table doesn't break, when the table does not give, it is more painful. Which is, I guess, one way to look at it. Still a botch, but one way to look at it. So Angle said he needed a moment to really collect himself and catch his breath. He had blood coming out of his mouth. He saw the blood. He said, oh, this is good. And you know, he starts spitting it out and lets the blood drip down from his chin for all, you know, added dramatic effect. This would not be the last Shawn Michaels springboard dive at WrestleMania out onto the announce desk where the table did not break, or at least it didn't break instantly. In fact, they just replayed that match on Friday night with Michaels and Ric Flair from WrestleMania 24. Flair moved out of the way. Michaels hit a moonsault onto the edge of the announce desk, and it did not break right away. It kind of collapsed about 2 seconds later. But upon impact, that table didn't have much give to it. And that bump looked like it sucked. Michaels looked like he immediately regretted that decision. Could have broken a couple of ribs on that. That looked just brutal. That was a very rough bump in that WrestleMania 24 match. So Angle goes up top for a moonsault, and I agree with Johnny Gargano. Gargano said, I don't understand the physics of it. I've never seen a prettier, more just smooth, beautiful moonsault in pro wrestling than Kurt Angle's moonsault. It's like he floats in the air. Guy, and Kurt's not like the biggest guy in the world, but he's no munchkin, for God's sakes. I mean, Kurt's a big dude. And for him to sort of get the height that he gets and to float, even in TNA, you know, when he was really suffering physically and was battling all kinds of injuries, he was still having cage matches and doing moonsaults like a madman off the top of the cage. And even from the top of the cage, it was like he would just float. You know, people talk about Io Shirai in NXT. And Io Shirai has a great moonsault, but it's not as good as Kurt Angle. It's really not. She doesn't get the kind of height on it that Kurt Angle does. Most people don't. So I'm with Gargano. I can't explain it. I don't know how he does it. But yes, Kurt Angle always had one of the best moonsaults in wrestling. Unfortunately for him in this match, he missed. He bounced. Shawn moved out of the way. And he went, basically took a belly flop on the mat. Knocked the wind out of himself. My favorite spot of the entire match. My absolute favorite spot of this entire match. And I love the match itself. Is the super kick spot towards the end. The super kick spot followed by the trademark, what I call angle kick out. Kurt has Shawn by the hair. Shawn's on his knees. Kurt is looking down, yelling at him, tap out, tap out, give up. It's over for you, Michaels. Just tap out. And as he's yelling at him and he's got Shawn by the hair yelling in his face, Shawn gets back to his feet. He gives Kurt a little shove just to put some distance between them. There was not a lot of distance between these two guys. Shawn hit a super kick that was picture perfect, right under the nose. You know, smacked the thigh so it made the great sound effect, but he kicked this fucking guy right in the face. And Kirk collapsed, the blood is on his face, you know, from his mouth. They laid there for a while. Sean crawls over, he gets the arm draped over him, and I call this a Kurt specialty. It's the Kurt Angle kickout, because Kurt Angle had a knack for waiting too long on the dramatic kickout to get his shoulder up. He waited a split second too long in multiple matches, and it didn't look good. Everybody would be like, come on. You know, the referee would have to hold their count up. It was the same thing here. He counted one, he counted two, and Kurt didn't get his shoulder up right away, so the ref kind of had a hold, and then Kurt got the shoulder up. Trademark Kurt Angle kickout. But then he put him in the ankle lock. Sean tapped out. Angle said there were a lot of great matches at WrestleMania 21. Hey, don't forget, WrestleMania 21 was the first ever Money in the Bank ladder match. That was pretty good. I'd say that was a pretty good match. You know, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio opened the show. Didn't have their Halloween Havoc 97 match, but they had a pretty good opening match. But nothing could come close to what these two guys did here in this match. There were 50 people in the back giving them a standing ovation when they came back in through the curtain. And they noted at the very end that Sean skipped the usual WrestleMania after party. He went right back to the hotel. He was with his wife, he was with his kids, and he said to his wife, he said, I am living the greatest life that any man could ever live. And he was getting all emotional retelling the story here, and he said, you know, my body should not have been able to do the things that I did that night. He says, my kids now are grown, they're 20 years old and 16 years old, and they still think I'm pretty okay, because I'm living the life a guy is supposed to lead, and I don't know what I've done to deserve that chance, but I am very thankful for it. The body of work that this guy has put together at WrestleMania over his career, going all the way back to the ladder match at Razor Ramon, is incomparable. There is nobody else that even comes close. You know, the match with Razor, Brett, Jericho, the triple threat at WrestleMania 20, the match with Kurt Angle, even the match with Vince McMahon, one of the best matches Vince McMahon ever had in his life. The retirement match with Flair and the story they told, the emotion there, and of course, the double shot with The Undertaker, WrestleMania 25 and 26, WrestleMania 25 being the greatest WrestleMania match of all time in the history of WrestleMania. That match was just, you know, Jim Ross summed it up best. Jim Ross, they brought Jim Ross in with Cole and whoever else was, I think Lawler maybe. Lawler was there. But they brought in Jim Ross. Thank God they brought in Jim Ross, because he, you know, lending his voice to that match made that match that much more special. And when the match was over, he summed it up best when he said, as a wrestling fan, how could you ask for anything more? That's what JR said. You know, Chris Jericho just did a watch-along of that match for his podcast, Talk is Jericho, with Marty Elias. Marty Elias was the referee for that match. He was fired a number of months later. He talked about that, too, at the end, supposedly for a dress code violation, because they had the whole dress code enforcement back then. He showed up one day, he was wearing a Metallica t-shirt, and Johnny Ace called him out on it, and there may have been other political things going on, but he claims that he was fired for violating the dress code. But he's gone on to work Lucha Underground as a referee. He's been around a long time. And he was very friendly with Shawn Michaels. Maybe that rubbed some people the wrong way. But he got the referee spot for that match. And so Jericho had him on his podcast. He shared a lot of very interesting little notes about the match. One of them being about the finish, where Shawn hit the moonsault off the top rope, Undertaker caught him in midair, and then hit the final tombstone for the win. He said that all day, Shawn was practicing that moonsault. He could not hit it to save his life. He couldn't do it. He was too far to the left. He was too far to the right. Or he would undershoot it. So they brought a crash pad in. He still couldn't hit the move. So they came up with a plan B. Shawn said, look, we get to the match. If I can't hit the moonsault, if I realize it, that I'm off target, you know, on the way down, I'm just going to land on my feet, Undertaker's going to give me a boot to the gut, pick me up and tombstone me, and that's it. We'll go home. So later on, they get to the gorilla position, and Shawn, I guess, is with Marty. They're praying together in the back. And now they're sitting next to each other. Shawn's getting ready to go out. And Marty just turns to him and he says, "So, are we still on for Plan B?" And Shawn turns to him. He stares him right in the eyes and he goes, "We're not going to need a Plan B." And Shawn just gets up and goes on out there. It was as if he had morphed into WrestleMania mode. And at that point, he knew it ain't going to be a problem. And it wasn't. He hit the moonsault perfectly. Undertaker caught him and he pinned him. He also said that when Shawn and Undertaker were in the trainer's room after the match, Undertaker literally just collapsed on top of the trainer's table because he was concussed. He claimed he had a broken collarbone, which I find unbelievable because he wrestled another 15 minutes. But he says Undertaker was all fucked up from that dive. I knew about the concussion. I didn't know about the broken clavicle. So Undertaker is just laid out on the trainer's table. Shawn's on the other trainer's table. Marty is in the room with them. All of a sudden, Triple H comes walking in. He was getting ready to defend his championship that night against Randy Orton in the main event. Triple H walks into the trainer's room, and he throws the belt down, and he goes, "How the fuck am I supposed to follow that?" Triple H, screwed again by someone else stealing the show before his big main event at WrestleMania. Hey, at least they had enough sense to close the show out with Shawn and Undertaker the following year and didn't put him on in the middle, right? Because, I mean, let's be honest, nothing was going to be able to follow what those two guys did. Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch was first to report that AEW has taped enough content. When they were in Georgia last week, they taped enough content to take them through at least several weeks, if not possibly a few months, of Dynamite on TNT, if it's needed. That is, of course, if they're not allowed to film, if they have to shut things down. They have enough content in the can that they could just put on TV that will take them. I don't know if it's going to take them through May, if it will take them through June, but apparently they taped a whole bunch of matches with the same talent pool that was there last week. That's the only talent pool they had to work from. And they just taped a whole bunch of stuff. And the idea is in between all of the stuff they taped is that they will have talent doing interviews and promos and maybe, you know, people like Matt Hardy doing fun segments from his compound, Jericho from his hot tub, stuff like that. And they'll splice it. Maybe stuff you would see, for example, on Being the Elite, that kind of content. And they'll splice that into the broadcast and they'll be able to have original programming for many more weeks to come on TNT. Double or Nothing is their next big show, May 23rd in Las Vegas. Again, not looking very likely for that show to happen, but I guess they've taped enough content to get them to Double or Nothing, and that includes the entire TNT title tournament, save for the finals. So we're going to see the tournament matches kick off on TV this Wednesday. They have taped the entire tournament. Whoever is in the finals, I don't know. I don't need to know. I don't want to know. We'll see how it plays out on TV. But the idea is that the finals, crowning a new champion, will take place in Vegas at Double or Nothing. If it doesn't happen at Double or Nothing, we'll have to just wait and see, you know, when they're able to tape that and add that onto TV. I love the Jericho Vanguard 1 segment. I don't remember another week. I'm really trying to think back on this. In this entire week of wrestling, when I look back at what were my favorite segments of the week, it was Jericho cutting a promo on a drone and sending in the hounds, right? Release the hounds. He sends his dogs after the drone after he gave the drone a t-shirt and it flew away. Okay. And by the way, he was sitting in his hot tub at first, drinking some of the bubbly. I love how he poured it into the glass and drank from the bottle anyway. I don't know how many of you picked up on that. So that was my favorite part of Dynamite on Wednesday. My favorite part of SmackDown on Friday was the John Cena Fiend stuff from the very end. And my favorite part of WrestleMania Night 1 last night was the Boneyard match. All of this, you know, kind of filmed, over-the-top type content that probably would piss a lot of people off, I loved it. Those are all those segments were my favorite segments from all the wrestling TV shows this week. I think I'm just totally souring on the actual wrestling portion of things, and I just want to see all these goofy skits and matches. That's what would make me happy. You want to distract me during this very tumultuous time? Just give me more of that. I'll be happy. NXT, I did catch NXT. Dakota Kai, she won the second chance gauntlet. No surprise there. She advances to the women's ladder match on TV, which I believe is this Wednesday, in fact. Dexter Lumis, we haven't seen him since last summer. He showed up on NXT television, he was very creepy, and then he disappeared. Maybe he had to go find some more victims. We saw Dexter Lumis back on TV this week. His music is very Stranger Things-esque. It actually works a lot better without a crowd. With a crowd, I don't know that the entrance music would work as well. Came out, he's got the big eyes. He's a very creepy dude. He took on Jake Atlas. This was Jake Atlas's in-ring debut here in NXT. They signed him in January, around the same time they brought in Mercedes Martinez. And I saw there were some people upset. I don't know the full story behind it. Some people were very upset at how they used Jake Atlas here on this show. I don't see what the big deal is. They do this with everybody. You know, is it the way that I would have debuted a new guy to have him just debut and lose if they, you know, have plans for him? No, I would debut him and, you know, put him in some, you know, enhancement matches and let him show off his personality and let him show off his moveset. That's how I would debut somebody. But they do this with everybody. I'd be more upset if he starts to show up on TV and then they yank him like they did Dexter Lumis. We haven't seen Lumis in probably 8 months. Where the hell has he been? Can't put somebody on TV one time or two times and then they vanish unless they're hurt. Maybe he was injured. I don't think he was. Then I can understand people having a problem. The way they used Jake Atlas, well, he got some offense in and he fucking lost. What is the big deal? It's the guy's first appearance. He put up a fight. It was a competitive, it was a mostly, I think, competitive match. It wasn't a total squash. I don't see what the problem is here. I don't understand what the issue is here. I understand apparently Jake Atlas I think he's openly gay. Is that the issue here? And then there are fans who feel he was mistreated. He was treated no differently than any other person who debuts in that same position. They debut these people and they lose. It has nothing to do with anything else other than WWE's own booking philosophy. This is how they use these guys. We'll put them on TV. We'll get people a little familiar with them. Let them lose a few times. Let them get a few losses under their belt, and then we'll start to build them up. If 6 months from now, Jake Atlas is nowhere to be found, then you can have an issue with it. This was one match. They do this with everybody. He is no different. He is no special. I don't see what the big deal is. Keith Lee. Keith Lee retained his North American Championship in the main event over Dominik Dijakovic. Damian Priest. I thought they had a good match. Keith Lee retains. He is still the North American champion. And it is even more noticeable here on NXT how much the lack of an audience really hurts the show. What is the big thing about the NXT TakeOver matches? Besides the matches themselves, which are, you know, more often than not, they're fantastic. It is the audience is so invested. They are so loud. They are so, you know, the back and forth chants. The crowd is as much a part of those TakeOver shows and how, you know, well-received those TakeOver shows as anything. You remove the audience from the equation, it really, really hurts these more. I would even argue more so than Raw and SmackDown. NXT is really handicapped by not having that audience there because they have a very passionate, loud audience. And now you've taken that away. So, okay, they had a good match, but this match was nothing like it would have been had TakeOver gone off in Tampa as originally planned. And it really hurts the show. Dark Side of the Ring this week covered the life and crimes of New Jack. At least this week's episode was about somebody who only attempted murder, which is an improvement from last week. New Jack was never one of my favorites. I never really got the appeal. I know he felt real. He wasn't somebody you wanted to, you know, fuck around with, but I never got the appeal in the guy. I don't doubt that if I ever looked at him cross-eyed, he would kill me. Absolutely. I'm sure he's seen a lot of shit in his life, and he's somebody who you don't want to mess with. You don't want to get on the man's bad side. But some of the things that he has done, he should have gone to jail for. And he almost did. He caught a lucky break more than once in court and managed to get out of his predicament. But he should have been blackballed by every promoter for some of the things that he's done. And that really just speaks, I think, more so to the wrestling industry than anything else, the fact that he wasn't. Some of the shit that he did, he should have been blackballed for. Promoters should have turned their back on this fucking guy for some of the things that he did. But by all accounts, if he likes you, or if you don't do anything to fuck him over, you can get along with him just fine. And when you listen to him speak, the guy, he's smart as a tack. I think he's actually way more intelligent than people give him credit for. Or anybody outside of wrestling who would have watched this special and all they see is this guy who goes in there and just tries to kill people. He's a pretty intelligent guy. He knows what to do. He knows what to say to get a reaction. He does some of the more entertaining shoot interviews, if you've ever seen clips from some of his shoots. But he's also batshit crazy. He had a child psychologist tell him. He didn't mention this in this special. But he had a child psychologist once tell him, when he was 12 years old, he went to go see a child psychiatrist or a psychologist, and the psychologist told him that he was crazy. He was 12 years old. So last week's episode was disturbing. This was disturbing for very different reasons. Jim Cornette, D'Lo Brown, The Sandman, and Tiny the Terrible, they were the talking heads for this. Cornette booked New Jack in Smoky Mountain. D'Lo worked with him in Smoky Mountain and got to know him pretty well. Sandman obviously worked with him in ECW. I thought it was very appropriate that they filmed Sandman sitting at a bar somewhere with a beer in his hand. It seemed very appropriate. And Tiny the Terrible was friends with Eric Kulas, Mass Transit. He ended up being on bad terms with Mass Transit. Eventually, New Jack got him a gig working for WWE. Got him on TV once on Monday Night Raw. But he is no fan of the way that New Jack took advantage of people in the ring. He makes that very clear. He is no friend of New Jack's. He got the name New Jack from the movie New Jack City with Wesley Snipes that came out in 1991. And I think it had a whole bunch of people in that movie, too. I couldn't believe it. I haven't heard New Jack City mentioned in so many years. And then I thought back and I said, you know what? I never saw the movie. I never saw New Jack City. And I was looking online to see if it was just kind of freely available, because sometimes people will upload these old movies to Daily Motion, or if you have Amazon Prime, sometimes you can get stuff for free, or it's on Netflix, and I can't find it anywhere. I guess at one time it was on Netflix, and now it isn't. So I want to see the movie. It's got Wesley Snipes, it's got Ice-T, it's got, I think, Judd Nelson, and Mario Van Peebles, and all these different people. And it sounds like a pretty interesting concept, but that's where he got his name from. He just thought it sounded cool. And that movie came out in 91. It wasn't too long after that, a few years later, maybe, that he made his wrestling debut. D'Lo thinks that a lot of his violence comes from his family life. And New Jack talked about growing up with a father that hated his wife, hated New Jack's mom. And his dad came home from work one day, stabbed New Jack's mom 5 times in front of the entire family. And she didn't die. She survived. But then later on, there was another incident where she was trying to leave. She was going to leave him. She was going to get the kids and leave. And the father shot her in the back of the leg to stop her from leaving. This is what this guy grew up around. And New Jack says, people wonder why I flipped the fuck out so much. This is how I grew up as a child. He had a fucked up childhood. Clearly that had an effect on him. Jim Cornette said that not too much is known about New Jack from his early life. His understanding is that he supposedly was a bounty hunter in a previous life that had a few justifiable homicides to his name. That is the belief, that he worked as a bounty hunter when he was younger. And I believe supposedly he killed at least 2 people. I guess you would say in the line of duty. But nobody knows for sure. Nobody knows for sure. Cornette talked about running Smoky Mountain. They needed a heel that could be believable. They were showing footage of some of the very controversial at that time, and would be even more so today. promos that New Jack would cut on television. And he decided he was going to incorporate real-life situations into his promo work. So, you know, they show the promo, one of the more infamous promos, where he was giving praise to O.J. Simpson. This was after he had committed the murders. And yes, O.J. did commit the murders. And Cornette, he was talking about how in Smoky Mountain, the audience, if you look out into the crowd, it was made up mostly of white redneck fans. So all New Jack had to do was go out there and just piss off all the white people. And they showed it. So they showed a promo from 1994 where New Jack gave a shout out to O.J. Simpson. He said, "Keep up the good work, because that's two less that we got to worry about. Keep up the good work." That was Jim Cornette's idea. There was a shoot interview a few years ago. Cornette was in the middle of his shoot. All of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. I think he was filming with Sean Oliver, and they opened the door, and there's New Jack and Mustafa. And Cornette had no idea they were there. You could tell he was a little nervous because he and New Jack didn't exactly end things on the best of terms. He didn't know what was going to happen. It's kind of like this nervous laugh. But New Jack went over, he gave him a hug, he's singing "Why Can't We Be Friends." He basically hijacked, New Jack hijacked, the Cornette shoot for about 15 minutes. But so as they're in the room together, he's talking about this. And he says, that was this guy's idea. That was this guy's idea. He says, one day Cornette comes over to New Jack. He tells New Jack, "Hey, go out and cut a promo." New Jack says, "Well, what do you want me to cut a promo about?" And he goes, "Just go say something to piss off white people. Go talk about OJ." So that was Jim Cornette's idea. And Jim Cornette, of course, just laughs nervously because, oh, it's wrestling, right? It's wrestling. You're just trying to get heat. But yeah, that was not actually New Jack's idea. That was Jim Cornette's idea. But he first got paired up with Mustafa in Smoky Mountain as the gangsters. And Mustafa used to, one of the more very odd revelations in this special is that Mustafa would used to roll pencil shavings into blunts and smoke them. And I remember in the special Sandman, and imagine the shit Sandman's done. And he tried to have Sandman do it once, and even Sandman was like, no, thank you. I'm not doing that. New Jack is like, "You're crazy. What are you doing?" "Oh, no, it's good. It's good." Pencil shavings. He would roll up pencil shavings and smoke pencil shavings. D'Lo, he was the head of security for the gangsters. As he explained, really, he was the bump guy. So New Jack and Mustafa would do their thing. And then at the end, D'Lo would come in. He'd be the one to get beat up and take all the bumps. And they got a ton of heat because here you had this group of black guys in the Deep South saying the things that they were saying, getting under the fans' skin. At a time when it was still very much real to them. It was still, wrestling was still a very real thing to a lot of the fans in that area, I'm sure, back then. So as you might expect, they took a lot of abuse. You know, verbal and otherwise. The N-word was thrown around like a baseball on opening day. New Jack himself, he used the N-word freely throughout this episode, and it was very amusing watching them bleep the F-word every time he would drop an F-bomb, but then they would leave the N-word uncensored. I mean, if you're going to let that word fly, then why even bother bleeping the F-word? I mean, what, are you worried about the FCC? The FCC's okay with one, but not the other? So the producer says to New Jack, he goes, "So was that, you know, the most fun that you had, or, you know, was that a fun time for you working in Smoky Mountain and getting everybody all riled up and pissed off?" And New Jack said, "No, it wasn't fun. You know, he was getting called the N-word all the time. You know, D'Lo talked about it again. He said it was thrown around like the word hello. But it's a weird thing because they were the heels, and so they wanted that." He goes, "It doesn't make any sense. It's like counterintuitive that you actually want the fans. If the fans are chanting racial shit at you, that means it's a good thing. That means you're doing your job. But on a personal level, imagine if you had to go to work every day, if you were D'Lo Brown or if you were New Jack, and as part of your job, you had to get people so angry at you that they would chant, or even if they weren't angry at you, and they're chanting the N-word at you every day. And this is life. This is what life is like for you every day." Yeah, I'll bet that wasn't a very fun time for him. Now, he didn't leave Smoky Mountain on the best of terms. Cornette accused him of leaving for ECW without giving his notice. Never forget that New Jack once worked a match with The Undertaker in Smoky Mountain Wrestling. It was a tag team match, but still. Never forget, Undertaker and New Jack once worked a match against each other, which is still something I just cannot wrap my head around. I didn't watch much Smoky Mountain up here in New York. There was a segment with the Gangstas and Jim Cornette once that I did see on YouTube. Cornette was trying to convince them, I think, to be their manager or something, and New Jack had this great line. I just thought it was so fantastic. He said, "I got a college education and a criminal record. I know how to make decisions." Just the way he said it, the way he delivered that line was fantastic. I have no idea if New Jack actually went to college, but whether he did or if he just made it up, I thought that was a great line. So then they get to the mass transit incident. You knew they were going to bring this up. You knew you can't tell the New Jack story without telling the story of the mass transit incident. Here's this kid who was 17 years old, but told everybody that he was 21. And he had showed up to this ECW show in Massachusetts. And he had a midget wrestler with him, which is where we meet Tiny the Terrible. He had Tiny the Terrible with him. Tiny the Terrible, by the way, lives in a shitty little apartment, and he put this VHS cassette in to show the producers. He's so proud of the time that he appeared on Jerry Springer. He goes, he loved it. He loved Jerry Springer. He says, "It's the reason I got most of the pussy that I got." So Tiny says that New Jack, he would, you know, if guys either went, against the plan that they had put into place or didn't cooperate, he would go off on them. And he bashes him. He says, "You cut that kid up, man. This is his kid's first real match, his first big match. You cut that kid up." And he really took New Jack to task for what he did, taking advantage of this kid. Yes, the kid gave a false age, but he carved this guy up like a fucking Thanksgiving turkey. I was not aware that Mass Transit had already had a few matches. I thought he was just a fan, some kid off the street who conned them into thinking that he worked matches before. But he did. He worked with Tiny the Terrible, Tiny's brother, who was also a midget wrestler. They had a routine where they would, you know, work together on the indies, and they probably took it around the horn. Paul Heyman saw a tape of them, and he invited them down for a tryout. Of course, when they got there, Tiny realized that he was kind of cut out of things, and Mass Transit went out there. I'm sure looking back on it now, he's probably grateful for that. Who knows what New Jack would have done to Tiny the Terrible. So they had a couple of ECW security guys they interviewed who worked the show that night. And they were saying, you know, they had no idea who this Eric Kulas kid was, but he claimed he was part of the show. And they said he lied and said that he was 21. And Axel Rotten wasn't there. He had called in sick. He had, or had a family emergency. As my phone goes off now.
Just a sec. Okay, I found this on the web for why didn't said that he was 21 Axelrod, wasn't there he called in sick to work at a family emergency. Check it out.
Fuck. Siri says, I found this on the web for why didn't said that he was 21 Axelrod, wasn't there he called in sick to work at a family emergency. I think my phone just had a stroke. I think my phone just had an aneurysm. Poor Siri. Let's try that again, shall we? So Axel Rotten had called in, said he had a family emergency, and so Eric Kulas took his place. There was going to be a tag team match that night. It was going to be him teaming up with Devon Dudley against, I guess, the Gangstas, unless it was New Jack and somebody else. I don't remember offhand. And he told Paul Heyman what he was going to do. He told Paul Heyman what he, you know, was going to do after Heyman said, look, you got X number of minutes, and you're going to, you know, beat up the fat guy. And he told Heyman, he says, what I'm going to do to this kid is going to get talked about for the next 10 years. And here we are now, 20 years later, still talking about it. So this poor kid is in this match against the Gangstas. And he had different, you know, he wanted, I think, to get color. He wanted to get blood, which is a whole, I mean, why would you even tell New Jack that? Why would you even do that? But New Jack said, you know, this whole situation, he found it very disrespectful because Eric Kulas had asked New Jack if he can get some offense in. He had ideas for spots in the match. He didn't know. It's a fucking 17-year-old kid. New Jack felt very disrespected. He said, I didn't want to kill him, but I wanted this kid close to death, which is a very nice thing to say. So they showed the incident. They have the footage of what happened, and New Jack was in the back getting high all day. He told D-Von, look, we're going to throw you out of the ring. You stay outside. So right away, D-Von gets thrown out of the ring, and he's out of the picture. And this guy took, I think it was I don't know if it was an X-Acto knife or a surgeon's scalpel. It was some giant, you know, blade. He took this thing, and he's trying to cut this guy open. And he says, at first, there's no blood. So he digs in deeper into the kid's forehead. And all of a sudden, he gives it like one big swipe, and blood is pouring out of this kid's head. I mean, blood is leaking. You can hear his father, who was there with him, his father, the kid's father, was at ringside or off camera, yelling, cursing, saying, he's only 17, he's only a kid. And you watch the incident play out, and all the blood, and the way they're just beating the shit out of this kid. And New Jack, you know, he's yelling, he's cutting a promo, he says, I hope this fat piece of shit bleeds to death, because I don't give a fuck. And security said our only goal was to get this kid out of the ring, and it was scary. They said, you know, it was touch and go there for a while. I guess it killed all the nerves in his forehead, and he had like he was permanently disfigured on the forehead. Which I mean, every wrestler who blades is permanently look at New Jack's forehead. Look at New Jack. Look at Dusty Rhodes, Abdullah the Butcher. All these old wrestlers have butchered themselves. So it was very disturbing to watch. And you could say, well, New Jack was totally not at fault because this kid had no business lying. Absolutely. The kid is in the wrong for lying. He shouldn't have lied. And he ended up paying a very steep price for it. But that doesn't, I mean, look, even if you say he lied about his age and maybe he asked somebody, you know, can you, you know, cut me or give me, you know, color or whatever. New Jack didn't have to go as far as he did. But it's not entirely his fault. I won't put all the blame on New Jack for what happened, because he's not totally at fault. The kid has to bear some responsibility in that as well. No doubt. No doubt about it. And Eric's father was freaking out in the back, and he was trying to get in New Jack, and supposedly he kept calling him the N-word and stuff, and he said he would have killed him if he could. If he could get to the father, he would have killed that old man. So they talked to Tiny the Terrible. And he almost got into a fight with Eric's dad because he refused to give him a ride back. So, you know, he wasn't really on the best of terms either. But the kid got 50 stitches in his forehead. 50 stitches. And again, it killed a lot of the nerves, had a giant scar in his forehead. And the kid passed away a number of years ago. I think complications from gastric bypass surgery, I believe, is what they said. And he didn't seem too bothered by it when they brought that up. They asked New Jack, hey, what do you think? And he didn't really have a whole lot to say, but charges were pressed against him. He almost went to jail for what happened in that mass transit incident. And he was asked about taking a plea deal, and his attorney said, you know what, I think I can get you off for free. We don't even have to worry about a plea. I think I can get you off. And so you have this very disturbing incident, and there's a jury, a six-person jury, five white women, and one older African-American guy, who New Jack says in court kept dozing off. And New Jack, he was joking. He says, I needed him to stay awake. He kept looking at that one black guy in the jury as his big savior. He goes, stay awake. I need you. Tiny the Terrible, he was part of the trial. His job was basically to show that if Kulas could wrestle with him, then he was qualified enough to wrestle with New Jack. Now, he had told New Jack, he said, look, he would love to work in WWE. Kind of like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of thing. And Jack said, look, I'll take care of it. He goes, if I get off here, I will take care of you. So Paul Heyman had to testify. They couldn't interview Paul Heyman for this for obvious reasons. So he had to testify during the trial. And he was asked about what Kulas's father had called New Jack. And Heyman said, well, he called him the N-word. And the lawyer said, well, for the record, I need you to say the word. And so Heyman just looked over at New Jack and he apologized. He said, I'm sorry. And then he said the word. And New Jack said that when Heyman said the word in court, the black juror, all of a sudden, he kind of, him and all the women, everybody on the jury really perked up and it got their attention. And so New Jack was found innocent. He got off and he got Tiny the Terrible a gig in WWE. It might have only been a one-shot, but they have footage from the Monday Night Raw episode. There was a whole thing where they brought out the, you know, the little people. I don't remember what the whole segment was. I think the McMahon-Helmsley faction was out there or something. It might have been just a one-week thing. But he said New Jack pulled it off. He doesn't know how he did it. He has no idea how he pulled it off, but he got him the gig in WWE. And they talked about all the crazy balcony dives that New Jack did in ECW, and he said he was snorting coke in the locker room basically every night, getting ready to do each dive, I guess to calm his nerves or something. And the higher he got, the higher the dives got. He'd be 10 feet up, 20 feet up, 30 feet up. And they did talk about the Vic Grimes one. I talked about this a few weeks ago. This is where the heat between him and Vic Grimes really began, because they were on a pay-per-view in either 99 or 2000. They were on an ECW pay-per-view. They were up. They were going to do a balcony dive. And Vic Grimes got cold feet. He goes, I can't do it. I can't do it. And New Jack is like, we'll go together. No, no, I can't do it. New Jack says, motherfucker, you're going down. And he grabbed him, and off they went. And upon landing, and Vic Grimes is a big guy, well over 300 pounds. He landed right on top of New Jack's head. And it, I think, fractured New Jack's skull. It caused permanent damage. He's got blindness in one eye. He still gets daily headaches to this day. It really fucked him up. In his mind, just because he hesitated. They say he who hesitates. And in this case, New Jack paid the price for it, even though he's the one who grabbed the guy and pulled him off with him. But that's kind of where the heat started. So now you fast forward a year or two. I think it was XPW. It was a different promotion. And they're going to work together. It's a scaffold match. And there's just stacks of tables in the ring as high as the eye can see. New Jack had bought a stun gun earlier in the day. He was out for revenge. Sandman said, hey, what's going on here? And New Jack says to him, I'm going to tase this motherfucker. So Grimes comes over to him before the match. He apologizes, you know, for what happened in the past. New Jack is pissed. He goes, this guy never called me one time to check up on me to see how I was doing. Never called me once. And again, he says he got high before the match. We see video from the match. They're up on the scaffold. He's using the taser. He is tasing the shit out of this guy. Grimes is trying to tell New Jack, I can't feel my legs. He's tasing the shit out of him. Can't feel my legs. New Jack says to him, you're not going to need them. Bombs away. And he tosses Vic Grimes off the scaffold. And off he goes. And everybody is who comments, Cornette and everybody, D'Lo, they can't believe this guy survived the fall. They cannot believe that he missed hitting the floor by about a foot. Hitting the ring post, which is what New Jack was aiming for. New Jack was trying to kill this guy. He's talked about this incident before. He has flat out admitted he was trying to kill him. He was hoping that he would hit the post and either break his back or kill him. If anything, he says he didn't throw him hard enough. He wanted him to hit the floor. He wanted him to hit the whatever it was, wood floor, pavement, I don't know, maybe they were in a gymnasium somewhere. He wanted him to hit the floor. Sandman was amazed that this guy didn't die. Cornette says it's just fool's luck that he wasn't paralyzed. One of the scariest things that I've ever seen was why Vic Grimes had an angel on his shoulder that day. The way he landed and bounced off the ropes, it kind of cushioned his fall. Amazingly, he only suffered a dislocated ankle. That was the only injury, aside from being stunned with a stun gun, which I'm sure didn't feel too good. He suffered a dislocated ankle. That was the worst of it. That was the worst of it. And I think New Jack, was it the Vic Grimes thing? I think he said to him after the fact, like, oh, now we're even or something like that. But then they get into a whole other story. I didn't realize they were going to tell the story on the show. And I had heard about this story before, but it doesn't get talked about like the mass transit incident or even the Vic Grimes scaffold toss. If they ever had an Olympic competition, scaffold tossing, New Jack would be the champion. He'd be a gold medalist. But they ask him, hey, was there ever a time that you feel like you went too far? And New Jack brought up the Gypsy Joe incident from 2003. Gypsy Joe was very old at this point. He had been wrestling for years and years, decades. He was in his 70s. New Jack knew that he was in his 70s, but when the match started, he says he forgot. How you forget something like that, I guess if you're high on coke, you forget. But he forgot that the guy was so old. Joe had this reputation for being, you know, this tough guy. He doesn't feel pain. He's impervious to pain. And he had talked to New Jack before the match, and he basically said to New Jack, hey, just follow me. And apparently that was a big mistake. For him to say that to New Jack was a very big mistake. So they get into this match, and they have footage, you know, of the match. It's on video. And part of Gypsy Joe's gimmick is he doesn't sell moves. You know, he doesn't sell. Well, that don't work for New Jack. He starts beating the crap out of this guy. You've got people in the audience screaming racial shit, screaming the N-word at New Jack, which is just making him even angrier. He grabbed a barbed wire baseball bat, and he beat the fuck out of this guy with this bat. He was hitting him in the head with this bat, full force. He wasn't pulling his... It's like, you know, pulling punches and stuff. He wasn't holding back at all. This guy's 73 years old. I don't care if the guy's an asshole. I don't care if the guy's not selling your moves. You don't take a fucking baseball bat full force to this guy's skull. You don't do that. There's no justification. Everybody will laugh and say, well, that's just New Jack being New Jack. He was disrespected. So it's okay that if someone disrespects you to take a baseball bat to their head, if they're 73 years old, really? What a great human being you must be. This is the kind of shit I'm talking about. You know, a lot of the New Jack stuff, you can laugh, it's funny, haha, but then there's shit like this that just makes your stomach turn. Now, just to give you some more, you know, kind of background on the whole Gypsy Joe incident. It was an NWA show. It was in April of 2003. And, you know, again, Gypsy Joe had this reputation for, you know, sometimes he himself would take liberties with some of the people he would step into the ring with. Supposedly, he did that with Taz. Taz's first match in Tennessee, I believe, was against Gypsy Joe, and Gypsy Joe may have taken some liberties with a young Taz. So the promoter had gone to New Jack and said, you know, you do a non-finish with Joe. Jack refused, and he said, if I let this guy beat me, or if we went to a no contest or something, it would kill my credibility because this guy is old as dirt. And I think what happened is, as the story goes, Joe got wind of that. He wasn't very happy about that. And, you know, it just kind of went from there. They were not on the best of terms even going into the match. But there was a great write-up on Gypsy Joe in The Observer after he passed away in 2016. And there's one incident in particular, and I just wanted to just recap this one story, just because I thought, for people who aren't aware of Gypsy Joe, have never heard of Gypsy Joe before, I thought this was kind of a colorful little story. So he would have been about 60 years old at the time that this happened. He was sitting at home one day on a Sunday, and a neighbor of his came over to his house and said, hey, you want to go fishing? And he said no, he wanted to stay home. Gypsy Joe wanted to stay home and just watch the baseball game on television. The guy insisted. He kept pushing him and pushing him and pushing him. Come on! So Joe said fine. He was going to go fishing. Instead of going fishing, they end up at a local bar. Joe had no interest in being at the bar, but the guy said, oh, we're just going to stop here and we're going to get some sandwiches. Well, sandwiches for the road. So they go in, and Joe sits down at a table. There's a female bartender. She comes over. She recognizes Gypsy Joe. She's talking to him about old wrestling and, you know, she's having a whole conversation with him. And she's like, well, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, my friend, you know, if he doesn't hurry up, I'm just going to leave because I don't want to miss the baseball game. So his friend is trying to talk to this woman the entire time. All she wants to do is ask Gypsy Joe about old school wrestling. So the friend gets angry. He gets angry at Gypsy Joe. And he goes outside. He comes back into the bar. And he's got a gun. And he starts yelling at Joe about, you're trying to steal my girl from me. And he shoots him. He shoots Gypsy Joe. Now, I don't know where he shot him. If he shot him in the arm, in the leg. I'm sure he didn't shoot him in the head or the chest. But he shoots Gypsy Joe. Now, remember, Joe's whole gimmick is that he sells no pain, right? He's impervious to pain. That's his wrestling gimmick. And even though he got shot, he goes and he beats the fuck out of this guy. So the people at the bar, they jump in, they call the police, the cops come, they were insisting, you gotta go to the hospital, you gotta go to the hospital. Joe tells the doctor, just stitch me up because I gotta go home and watch the baseball game. And they said, look, there's no way we can release you. You're bleeding internally. There's no way we can let you go. So I think he ended up in the hospital for a few days. The neighbor got arrested. The neighbor went to prison for shooting him. And I think in the story it said he ended up dying in prison. And the whole thing was, you know, he wanted to go out with the woman, with the waitress at the bar. Found out she was a big wrestling fan. And the neighbor thought, well, if I bring in Gypsy Joe, that'll be brownie points for me. So the guy knew that she was a wrestling fan. He knew what he was doing. That's why he brought the guy to the bar in the first place. It's not his fault the woman didn't want to talk to him. But when he saw Joe hitting on her, he went crazy. He lost his mind. And so Joe is asked sometime after this incident. He gets asked, he goes, is that true? Is that true that, you know, he said, no, I wasn't hitting on her at all. He said, no, she was fat and ugly. I just wanted to go home and watch baseball. And then apparently he was wrestling within a few weeks of being released from the hospital. Again, I don't know where he got shot, but I remember reading that story and thinking, there's no way that could possibly be true. And I still wonder, you know, if there are elements of that story that aren't true, but apparently it was. Apparently, I guess it was documented in the news, and the guy went to jail and everything. So that I thought was kind of a cool story that gives you a sense of who Gypsy Joe was, the guy that New Jack decided to rough up with a baseball bat to the head. And that was not the last incident that New Jack would be part of. That was not the last incident that he would be part of. Cornette said, you know, WWE, they were never going to touch New Jack. That's why we never saw New Jack in WWE. I do recall there being rumors around the time that they did the angle on SmackDown where John Cena was stabbed. He was feuding with Carlito at the time. Remember, he was stabbed at a club or something. And they did the big reveal. It was Jesus. It was Aaron Aguila, I think, was the one who portrayed Jesus. So he was Carlito's bodyguard. There were like rumors online that maybe New Jack was going to be brought in to be the guy to, you know, feud with Cena. He's the one who stabbed Cena. I don't know if that's true. I never saw that reported by anybody I would consider to be credible or anything. But WWE did bring in New Jack for a tryout in 2005, which is hard to believe. But I believe that is true. I believe they brought him in for a tryout in 05. I think he wrestled Val Venus in a dark match. It might have been empty arena before the crowd even came in. Apparently he looked terrible. The match was shit, so they passed on him. But imagine WWE giving New Jack a tryout just 3 years before they went PG. That would not have worked out well for them. So they got into a whole other incident with New Jack in Florida. There was a promoter down there who, you know, he said that, you know, New Jack was living with him for a while, and New Jack is a comedian. He's also a great cook. And they say, and they're like, well, what is this great dish that New Jack can cook? Spaghetti. It sounds like me. I can put pasta in a pot and boil it. That's my wonderful contribution to the culinary world. Apparently, New Jack cooks some mean spaghetti. But he got booked in the promotion down there against a wrestler named Hunter Red. And Hunter Red wanted to work with New Jack. He wanted to have a match with New Jack. Promoter said, it's a whole new ball of wax if you want to work with New Jack. I don't know if you know what you're getting yourself into here. So he goes over to New Jack backstage, I guess, at this particular indie event, for which, again, they have footage that they aired here on the app. I like the fact they have footage of all these things. They're not just telling you. They're showing you exactly what happened. And I guess Hunter Red went over to New Jack before, hey, so what are we doing? And New Jack said, well, we'll talk about it, you know, after. And apparently Hunter Red got very pissed off. He got very aggravated. He stormed off. And New Jack admitted that, you know, he was also snorting coke. He was drinking vodka. So basically his usual pre-match routine. Some people stretch. Other people snort coke and drink vodka. That was the way that New Jack prepared for his matches. They get in the ring, and Hunter Red starts stiffing him. He is stiffing New Jack in the corner, and he's hitting him in the nose. And you could just see this is not going to end well for Hunter Red. Apparently, New Jack had like a Wolverine claw in his pocket. Does he just walk around every day with a fucking Wolverine claw? I guess so. He pulls out this Wolverine claw. He's breaking the blades off. And he starts stabbing Hunter Red with the claw, with the blades. And they show D'Lo watching this on a laptop. He's mortified by what he's seeing. Cornette's watching this, and he's going, oh, man, he's stabbing that guy. He goes, this doesn't do the image of pro wrestling any good. No shit. I think that's New Jack's whole career summed up in a nutshell. Does not do the image of pro wrestling very good. He stabbed this guy 9 times. He said it wasn't 16 times like the news said. Just for the record, New Jack wanted to make sure everybody knows. It wasn't 16. It was 9. I stabbed the guy 9 times, and I know that. You know how I know that? Because I counted. This fucking guy's unbelievable. So the police get called, and they're told there's this black guy in camouflage who's stabbing a white guy, and the police come, they arrest New Jack, and he goes to jail. He's facing 15 years. He's facing 15 years behind bars. He got off of the mass transit incident, but now he's facing 15 years in jail. Hunter Red visits him in the slammer. He says, look, I'll drop the charges. If you agree to go on the road with me, we'll turn this into an angle and we can make a whole bunch of money. And New Jack probably sees this guy, what a fucking idiot. He goes, yeah, if you drop the charges, we can do that. And then, of course, Hunter Red dropped the charges. New Jack got off. And then he hasn't talked to him since. New Jack was not going to work with this guy. So, producer at the very end, he goes to New Jack, if they ever made a movie based on your life, how would it end? What would the ending of a New Jack movie look like? And he starts cackling. He starts laughing uncontrollably, laughing his ass off. And he says, it would be me sitting in a wheelchair, snorting coke, getting high as shit, flipping everybody off, saying, thank you, bitches. And I love that they have the reenactment in the background. They do these little reenactments on the show. And you see a guy sitting in a wheelchair, snorting coke, putting his middle fingers up, saying, thank you, bitches. And that's how the episode ends. It was every bit as crazy as you would have expected an episode on New Jack to be. I could appreciate the fact that New Jack, like I said, I think he's actually a lot smarter than people give him credit for. But some of the shit that he did, he should have been blackballed from the wrestling business. This goes beyond, well, he's real. We need more real people like that in wrestling. There's a fine line between, you know, being a guy that people respect and standing up for yourself and maybe stiffen somebody if they piss you off and just trying to carve him up like a turkey and trying to kill him because they did something that made you upset. Or hitting a 73-year-old guy repeatedly in the head with a barbed wire baseball bat. That shit don't fly. To me, there's no glorifying that. The fact that that kind of shit is celebrated is sickening. So I think he should have been blackballed a long time ago. But I can appreciate the fact that the guy was an incredible promo. You know, he probably wasn't much of a wrestler, but he never really was looked at as being some kind of great mat technician. That wasn't his gimmick. His gimmick was that he would go in there and beat the hell out of you. He was a brawler. He would use weapons. He would cut you up. I mean, that's who New Jack was. Great promo, and not somebody that I would want to mess with. But the stuff that he got away with, he's very lucky he got away with some of the shit that he pulled. Now, Kevin Sullivan is going to be appearing on the Jim Cornette Experience this Friday, April 10th. He's going to be giving his side of the story, the allegations levied against him in the Benoit special that he abused Nancy. So he's going to respond on Cornette's podcast. Here's the remaining schedule. We have all the dates now for all the remaining episodes. This Wednesday, it's the Brawl for All that WWE did. They're going to be talking to Jim Cornette, Jim Ross, Vince Russo, Bart Gunn. They're all interviewed for that episode. Godfather. On April 14th, it is Jimmy Snuka and the death of Nancy Argentino, which is one of the ones I'm looking forward to. The one I'm looking forward to the most, the one I'm most intrigued by, is April 21st, Dino Bravo. The death of Dino Bravo. April 28th, Dr. D. David Schultz. May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, Herb Abrams in the UWF. That's going to be a wild one, too. You talk about cocaine and women and all kinds of crazy shit. You're going to get that in the Herb Abrams episode. May 12th is an episode on the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal, and the finale, which I expected it to be. The season finale, May 19th, which is only days before the anniversary of his death, so I guess it's kind of appropriate, is the episode on the life and death of Owen Hart. So that is the remaining Dark Side of the Ring schedule. We will have a Brawl for All review here on the podcast next Sunday. Time for this week's RSPW Rewind, taking a stroll down memory lane to see what people were talking about, what fans on the internet were talking about back when the internet wasn't quite what it is today. We've got some random posts to comb through, starting with December 11, 1995, a post by Rob Spare about Royal Rumble 1996, which was coming up in a matter of weeks. Says, well, I can see the WWF is still not listening. I received my cable guide for pay-per-view in January, and it seems the price has gone up. Last year, it was the standard $24.95, but this year, it's $29.95. I'll still buy it, but it better be good. This was the price increase to $29.95 for all WWE pay-per-views. This is a big deal back then. That was the same year they started offering the In Your House shows for $14.95. Dark Sun says, what? They're raising prices on all pay-per-views? I might just have to skip one or two of them now. And Herc Wad, that's a weird name, Herc Wad says, well, the pay-per-views more often than not are lower than your expectations, and with higher prices imminent, you shouldn't order most of them. I have taken a drastic measure. I pretty much stopped watching all pay-per-views thanks to RSPW. I just take about 4 minutes and I look for the results. Most of the guys that post give clear results, and if I at least have the news, I don't want to go through the rest holes. That's interesting. Kind of similar to what I hear today, when people tell me that they stop watching the shows and only listen to the podcast to keep up with the news. I guess 25 years ago, that was the form that it took back then, and today it's, hey, I listen to your show, so I don't have to watch the shows anymore. November 23rd, 1996, a post by Eli. How will WWF fill 70,000 seats at the Royal Rumble? Actually, they didn't. They didn't fill 70,000 seats. They were aiming for 70. They were talking about it on television as 70 in the weeks leading up to the show. But they announced 60,000, which is still impressive. It's still very impressive for a non-WrestleMania show. At a time, you got to remember, when business was hardly booming for the company. 96, 97, they weren't doing their best business back then. And they had a legit 60,000 people. Now, I do believe that show was largely papered. I think there was a lot of papering, a lot of freebies going on. So there was that. But they did have 60,000 people in the building. Anyway, Eli says, the WWF hasn't been in an arena that big since SummerSlam 92 at Wembley Stadium, if I'm not mistaken. How will they be able to fill the Alamo Dome? December's In Your House will be packed with stuff to hype the Royal Rumble for sure. I expect to see HBK beat Sid for the belt and Bret Hart to win the Rumble in January, but that's not going to be enough. Shawn Michaels won't be turning heel until or after the Rumble, since the event is in San Antonio. The WWF's going to need AAA, ECW, independent wrestlers, Japanese wrestlers, and whoever else they can find to make this work. They must have something big in mind. What's with that huge surprise in the WWF that they're hyping for the beginning of the year? Jack Epstein responds, Shawn is getting the title shot at the Royal Rumble. Bret will win at In Your House. Shawn versus Sid won't draw 70,000, but a Bret versus Shawn ladder match will. He says Austin will win the Royal Rumble. The big surprise that they've been talking about is a late night, quote, extreme wrestling show on Saturday nights starting on January 4th. Well, we did get Shawn and Sid, but I do like Jack's idea. I do like Mr. Epstein's idea for a Bret-Shawn ladder match much more than what we got with Shawn and Sid at the Royal Rumble. And that extreme wrestling show that he mentioned turned out to be the debut of Shotgun Saturday Night. There's something very, very wrong when I go to search for those shows on WWE's own network, and I can't find them. So I have to find them on Daily Motion and watch them all on there. What the hell do you have a network for if you're not going to put all your content up there? I've found that going through a lot of these old posts that RSPW also had a common opinion that WWF and WCW were constantly stealing ideas from RSPW. And for the record, I can fully believe that both companies had people working for them whose job it was, or part of their job description, was to scan the dirt sheets and scan the online message boards and report back with things that were being said. It happens to this very day with podcasts. With WWF back then, it was Howard Finkel who was said to possibly be the person who would check all these things out and report back. Now, was it Howard or somebody else? Who knows? But I've noticed an unhealthy obsession on these old RSPW posts with claiming that certain ideas and certain phrases were stolen and used on TV, and they're not all troll posts. You'll find the troll posts here and there, but they're not all troll posts. Case in point, this post from January 22nd, 1996, from James Fabiano, titled "Perfect Should Pay Royalties to RSPW." Did anyone notice that Mr. Perfect stole one of RSPW's jokes during the Royal Rumble? When Aldo Montoya is coming down to the ring, Hennig says he has his jock on the wrong end. Janice Johnson poured cold water on that assertion by reminding James that he actually stole that from Doc Hendricks. Doc Hendricks said the same thing about 6 months ago on TV. Another example of this, and this may be the funniest of them all, when you think about this person stealing promo material from RSPW of all places, April 30th, 1996, a post by Patrick Davis titled "Proof! Ric Flair Reads RSPW." Just think of the absurdity of that title before I even go any further here. Ric Flair Reads RSPW. Did Ric Flair even know how to work a computer back in 1996? It was about 3 weeks ago, somebody started a thread titled "Ric Flair's Best Interviews." And it basically talked about Flair's best interview. Well, gee, thanks, Patrick. I never would have known otherwise had you not have cleared that up for me. It says, I added my 2 cents in, and I added my favorite Ric Flair interview. It was back in the WWF days, 1991, I believe, leading up to the Royal Rumble in 92, where he won the title. Ric Flair is facing the front, and Perfect has his back to the camera. Flair starts off, "Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble." Just then, Perfect turns around and says, "When you're perfect in every way." And then Flair goes off on his usual brilliant interview. I posted this about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Flair has not repeated this since that one time in the WWF, and to my knowledge, has never uttered it before. Now here's the kicker. This is him talking. He goes, now here's the kicker. On the April 28th Monday Nitro, Flair comes walking to the ring and he utters the same phrase, "Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way." Now, you tell me, I just posted this 3 or 4 weeks ago as one of his best interviews that he's ever given. He hasn't spoken it in 5 years, but a month after I post it, he says it again. Coincidence? Who knows? But I'd like to think that Ric Flair read my message and used it. Well, there you have it, folks. You can thank Patrick for providing maybe the greatest promo man in the history of the wrestling business with the material that he so desperately needed during his time in WCW. RSPW is truly an amazing place. Oh, wait. What's that? Hold on, I'm being told something in my ear here, in my imaginary earpiece. Okay, I'm being told that we have a reply. We have a reply from somebody with the name Nature Boy. That's how he spelled it, N-A-I-T-C-H-A, Nature Boy. And he used the number 8 in his username. Nate Sherboy. Anyway. "Are you crazy?" he asks. "Flair used that way back in the NWA days." Cram says, not Graham, Cram. "Patrick, he's been saying it for about a month now, ever since he started messing with Savage's head again." Felix came to the rescue, trying to back up his man Patrick. He says, "True, but he hadn't done it in a while, and this might have reminded him." So I guess the mystery persists here all these years later. Did Ric Flair, in fact, get his material for that one promo in WCW from Patrick? Was he reminded by Patrick of that promo he did in the WWF and decided, you know what, that's damn good material. I think I'm going to use it again here in WCW. We may never know the answer. March 7th, 2000. The Almighty Broderick. With a post titled, Crash Holly, WWF Rips Off RSPW. So as I tuned in and I saw the Mean Street Posse trying to pin Crash Holly as he slept in his hotel room. Is it just me, or did somebody on this news group come up with that same angle over the weekend? Macaroni Tony agrees. Best name ever. Macaroni Tony says, yes, some guy posted here last week that he would love if people burst into Crash's room and tried to pin him, and that's exactly what happened. WWF does read this group. Hopefully they will follow our advice and fire Viscera. These people are unbelievable. Holy shit, they really did fire Viscera. A few months later, in August, Viscera was released from his WWF contract. Maybe they really did listen to RSPW. This has been your weekly reminder that WWE reads RSPW. And if they do, that would explain a lot when it comes to the state of WWE television these last several years. No questions this week, but I did want to mention this before we end things here. One of the writers on IGN posted a top 10 list of the best wrestling games of all time. And I wanted to just run through this list here, comment on it real quick, and then have you guys chime in, because I know we got a lot of gamers who listen to this show, who play a lot of the WWE games and other wrestling games from over the years. I used to play a lot of them myself, more so then than now. But here's the list, starting from number 10, working all the way up to number 1. This person put Saturday Night Slam Masters at number 10. I've heard a lot about this game over the years. I've never actually played it before, but I know it was very popular, and so that's fine. It seems like it would deserve a spot on this list. That's number 10. Number 9, and I would have had this maybe up a little bit, but Fire Pro Wrestling World. Fire Pro Wrestling goes back many, many years. And a couple of years ago, they rebooted it, or they came out with another sequel or edition called Fire Pro Wrestling World, and a lot of the New Japan characters were in the game. I think I even did a Sound of Gamer on it at least once. Fire Pro is great. Fire Pro is always a very fun game. Number 8, WWF WrestleMania the Arcade Game. Used to play the shit out of this thing when I was younger. And yes, it did rip off Mortal Kombat. A lot of Mortal Kombat qualities in the game, including the different rounds. And Mortal Kombat was made by the same company. I think it was Midway, I think, was the maker of this game and Mortal Kombat. So they were kind of from the same family. But this was a game that, it was very over the top. So you had, for example, Doink the Clown would hit people with like a giant flower and a giant hand. And Undertaker would throw tombstones and souls at people. You would hit people and objects would come out of them. You know, hearts would come out of, I think, Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. It was a limited roster, too. They had, I want to say maybe six or eight playable characters in this game. Mr. Perfect was going to be one of them. Apparently, he just never showed up for the filming, for the motion capture. They would keep rescheduling with him and he would keep, bailing on them. So Mr. Perfect was going to be in the game. He ended up not being in there. But you had Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, Lex Luger, Bam Bam Bigelow, Doink, Razor Ramon, Yokozuna, Undertaker. I always had a lot of fun playing the game. It was one of those button mashers, and again, all the crazy stuff that the weapons that you could use and stuff. But it was not a very realistic game. But the motion capture, the guys looked pretty good. I actually thought visually, like graphics wise, the game looked pretty good. Number 7. WWF WrestleMania 2000, which came out for the N64. Number 6, Ultimate Muscle, Legends vs. New Generation, for Nintendo GameCube. I am not familiar with this game, I never played the game, so I can't really comment on it, but that came in at number 6. Number 5 was WWF, or WWE, I should say, 2K14. See 2K14 on this list at number 5. It is the only 2K game of the entire WWE 2K series that made this person's list. Have there really been no better WWE 2K games since 2K14 came out? Like, in the last 5 or 6 years, has there not been another quality version that would be better than 2K14? I know 2K20 was an embarrassment, that I know. But was there really no improvement from 2K15 to 2K19? I find that very sad. Number four, WWE All-Stars, where all of the wrestlers were basically on steroids, beating the hell out of each other. It was like a cartoon version of a WWE game. Number three was WWE SmackDown Here Comes the Pain for PlayStation 2, after which came the SmackDown vs. Raw series, but Here Comes the Pain is still looked upon as one of the best WWE games ever made. And I do remember playing Here Comes the Pain. I had a lot of fun playing that game, so I have no issue with that being on this list. But then we get to the final two. Number two is a game called Def Jam, Fight for New York. Now, this is a game, it's a fighting game. Features a lot of rap artists. They have Snoop Dogg as a character in the game, Method Man, Redman, Fat Joe, Lil' Kim, Joe Budden, Ice-T, Ghostface Killah, Exhibit, Ludacris, Busta Rhymes, Flavor Flav, Sean Paul, Danny Trejo is in the game, Carmen Electra is in the game. A very interesting mix of characters in this game. My question is this. Can this really be considered a wrestling game? Now, I admit that I just got done watching a Boneyard match last night at WrestleMania. So if that's considered a match, then I guess this game could be too. It could be considered a wrestling game. But I it's a question worth asking. I mean, it's very high on this person's list. Number two, would you consider Def Jam Fight for New York to be the number two greatest wrestling game ever created? Is it even a wrestling game? I never played it, so I can't speak for how good or bad the gameplay is. I've read up on it. I've watched some of the gameplay on YouTube. But I don't think I would call this a wrestling game. Maybe I'm wrong. Number one, I don't think is going to be much of a debate. The number one greatest wrestling game ever made. It would not be number one on my list, but it's a matter of personal preference, and I know it would be number one probably on a lot of people's list, is WWF No Mercy for the N64, the last WWE game ever released for the N64 game console. It was a great game. It was a great game. It was very easy to play. Like the gameplay itself, the controls and everything, it was a lot of fun to play. I played it not too often. I usually would go over to a friend's house. He had the N64. I went up to SNES. I had Genesis. I had some of the portable ones like Game Boy and Game Gear, but never had an N64 of my own. I had a friend. He had everything. N64, Neo Geo. I mean, he had everything. Sega Saturn. So I always used to have fun playing No Mercy. And I look around online and it's a very critically acclaimed game. So I'm not taking issue with ranking No Mercy so high. My issue would be there were two very big omissions from this person's list. And I understand it's just one writer, but I happened to see it, so I wanted to comment on it. Two very big glaring omissions on this person's list. Number one, and this is probably my all-time favorite, WWF WrestleFest, the arcade game. I understand that it was not a console game, it was an arcade. Maybe he didn't count it for that reason. WrestleFest, the arcade game, I used to feed quarters into that machine like it was, I was running out of money and it was the last quarters I had to my name. I would feed that machine, I would have so much fun playing that game, and when I realized that I could play the ROM online, I was in heaven. I did a Sound Off Gamer playing WrestleFest a number of years ago that you could find on my YouTube channel. WrestleFest was the shit. It really was. And when I found out WWE was rebooting it, they were coming out with a new edition, a new version of WrestleFest as a mobile game on your phone a few years ago, I got very excited until I actually saw what it looked like. And it looked nothing like the original WrestleFest. I was hoping they were basically porting over the old WrestleFest, maybe with newer characters. That'd be pretty cool. The old WrestleFest sprites and the old look of the game, Royal Rumble mode, Saturday night's main event mode, the blue bar cage, but you have like the current roster. That could have worked. The WrestleFest they came out with was nothing like the WrestleFest of old. To me, that's number one. But the other omission, WCW NWO Revenge. I think Revenge more so than World Tour. Revenge was a great game. I used to go to the store and play it in the store all the time. How do you leave that out? How does that not even make the top 10 of the greatest wrestling games of all time? No WCW NWO Revenge. That's a pretty glaring omission to me. So now you guys can chime in and let me know what you think. What would your top 10 look like? What do you think about the whole Def Jam debate here? Is it a wrestling game? Is it not a wrestling game? And do you agree? WrestleFest and WCW NWO Revenge. Two very big omissions from that list. WrestleFest will always be my favorite. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Hopefully we'll get back to mailbag questions once WrestleMania is out of the way. And I want to work on a new video inbox for the YouTube channel. So email me your questions. I will try to get to as many of them as I can. Also, just be aware, I mentioned this earlier, and it sucks, but this is what YouTube does. YouTube giveth, YouTube taketh away. A lot of people who are subbed to my channel have not been getting notifications. And this has been a problem across the board for other channels as well. Some people got the notification last night when I was going live for WrestleMania. Some didn't. This inconsistency of it is just maddening. And I've reached out to YouTube. They have no good answer for it. Hopefully they'll get their act together. But I'm sure it cost me a lot of views last night. It sucks, but what the hell are you going to do? So just be aware, if you are listening to this before night two, I am going live again tonight at 10 p.m. when WrestleMania goes off the air. Come on over to the YouTube channel. If you're not subbed, hit the sub button. But I will be live again on video for WrestleMania Night 2. Full recap and review of tonight's pay-per-view. This really is the night. This is like the big night, right? This is the original night. This is the Sunday night edition of WrestleMania. Arguably the bigger of the two nights. Hopefully, they'll have something comparable to the Boneyard match, which was my favorite thing of the weekend so far. Can they top that? Can they top themselves from last night? But I will be live on YouTube. If you don't get a notification, I am going live. So join me there. We'll have some fun tonight. Thank you all for the support. Have yourselves a great week. Please stay safe wherever you may be. I will see you tonight and again on Wednesday for my AEW Dynamite live stream on YouTube. And 647, episode 647 of The Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Are you the person that's talking on WWE?
Well, I am talking about WWE right now. Is that your sister in the background?
Yeah.
Tell her not to watch The Fiend wrestle John Cena, because The Fiend is going to murder John Cena. I'm gonna
what?
I gotta let you go. Sorry. What can I say? I gotta warn the kids. The kids need to be aware of what's going on. Now, if I didn't warn that child just now, he would watch WrestleMania. He would watch John Cena be torn to shreds. He would be scarred for life. I just did that kid a favor. Don't look at me. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to hell.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.